auditor or auditors, as well as continue with the remainder of our induction program. Just to indicate quickly that we could not secure the afternoon slot to finalize our exercise for today. As you know, today there's questions to the Deputy President and to the Peace and Stability Group. So we, for those reasons, couldn't secure. The suggestion was made that we meet after the House, but we thought that might just be a bit too hectic and that perhaps we should identify an alternative date. We're proposing the what? The 4th of September to conclude the outstanding part. The pity our induction is splintered into so many bits and pieces, but hopefully in between we'll do our own reading and catching up so that when we meet again, you know, we're better equipped to engage even more robustly. But on that note, thank you very much. Over to you, Auditor General.
Are you looking at 9 o'clock on Friday, September the 4th?
Yes. The reason being that, for example, this Friday is the Auditor General is not available. Next Friday, I was scheduling a rules review of rules committee, which is the other responsibility I have, although it's going to be shifted as well. But we'll deal with those administrative issues further at a later stage. Over to you, Auditor General.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, just an intro from our side. What we intended to achieve today, before the change to the date for the annual report, which was meant to happen tomorrow, was to have the committee interact with the audit committee on two aspects. One of the aspects is what we highlighted last week on Thursday at the first session of our induction program, and that was to urgently engage with the audit committee on the matter of the need to finalize processes around the appointment of the external auditors of the office. As we indicated, the current mandate of the incumbent auditors is about to expire in a few months, and so we thought this would be an opportunity for SCOWEC to take on from where the previous third parliament SCOWEC left off on this process, and we felt that the audit committee will then be engaging with the committee on that matter. The second issue was with regards to the audit committee sharing its insights with SCOWEC on the outcomes of this financial year ending March 2009, in preparation for the engagement that we are going to have with the committee on the annual report. As I said, initially that date was meant to be tomorrow, but because of some practical challenges, it's now been moved, but we still felt that for purposes of engaging with the audit committee, maybe this date that we've already secured will suffice to have some insights from the audit committee on its work in the past year, which is linked to what we're going to be coming back on the annual report for. And then once that engagement is complete, as you indicated, Chair, we will continue with the part pertaining to our second day of induction. And as you said, if it is not concluded today, there's another opportunity to finish off on the 4th of September. So we came in today with the understanding that we've got up to lunchtime today, and the very first part of the engagement is to engage with audit committee-related matters, and thereafter we pick up where we left off from last week on the induction program. And that's really where we're coming from. And I think we are on the same page with regards to your understanding.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I don't know how you want to proceed now.
I'm probably Chair, in terms of starting maybe just as a formal introduction before I hand over to the Chair of the Audit Committee to once again, on behalf of all of us in the office, to introduce to the committee formally, as it were, in the session, the members of the Audit Committee. At the far end is the chair of the audit committee, Mr. Peter Moyo. Who has been chairing the committee for, I think, the last 5 years, if I'm not mistaken. The last 3.5 years. next to Mr. Peter Moyo is Mr. John Bisman Simmons, who has also been a member of this committee for almost that period of time, and Professor Karen Barak, who has also been a member of the committee. There's a member of the committee that, due to issues of potential conflict, had to fall off from the audit committee, Ms. Ntombi Zanele Mbele, who is no longer in the committee. But initially, we had 4 members of the audit committee. And I would like to hand over to Mr. Peter Moyo to take the committee through the 2 issues that I've introduced earlier.
Chairman, thanks very much. On behalf of the audit committee, I think it's a privilege for us to once again engage Mr. Scott. With your indulgence, we'll possibly just ask to discuss one other thing which we've discussed in the past with the previous squad, how often your body wants to engage with the audit, with the audit committee. From our side, when we talk about the financial statements, because we've gone through what we believe is a thorough and rigorous process with the office, we felt there was absolutely no reason for us to even think of having a session with SCOAG without the members of the office. Because, I mean, the way that we've worked with the officers is that we're very open with one another. If there are issues, we deal with them. And we felt as a committee that we're very comfortable to talk about any of the issues in their presence. However, if the committee feels there's anything that they need to just have only in a closed session with us, that's fine. But from our side, we do not have that requirement. I'll start off with the financial statement. We're hoping that the committee will have gone through the financial statements. So I would like them to just deal with our role relative to those financial statements. Essentially, our role is one of oversight. I'll say we're the second layer in terms of controls. The first and most important layer in terms of controls is actually the office itself, the management of the office, and then the audit committee. We have to look at the effectiveness of the controls, the appropriateness of the controls, the attitude that the office has towards those things, and the management of risks, and ultimately leading to the financial statements and the opinion that's expressed in those financial statements. We are happy to say that the financial statements of the Auditor General's office received no qualification.
Chair, sorry, which statements we don't have?
No, Chair, that's why I'm saying that we're hoping that when you look at, we know that we haven't gotten those financial statements, but the financial statements came already. Yeah. I know, that's why I said the committee hasn't seen those, but the financial statements are ready. That's why I started off by saying that we'll have hoped to have this meeting when we've gone through them, but we can actually leave you a flavor of our view so that when you look at them, you have that our report is contained, Chair, in those financial statements. The financial statements that the committee will be receiving have got a clean audit report, and it is the view of this committee that that opinion is appropriate. We've engaged fully with the external auditors, we've engaged fully with the internal auditors. It's actually pleasing that over the years, as we've been on this journey, we've actually seen real improvements in the office. But the other more pleasing thing is that, Chair, in the event that issues are picked up which could actually raise concerns, office does have a positive attitude in actually taking those issues. And therefore, as the audit committee, we are comfortable that even the environment within the Office of the Auditor General lends itself to having very good control. I'll also add, Chair, that the view of this committee has always been that it is important for the Office of the Auditor General to be very vigilant and actually quite clean on some of these issues, because if that office is compromised, our democracy is compromised. So we're very happy that the attitude in the office, starting right from the top with the Auditor General, with the Deputy Auditor General, with the execs, is that they tackle some of those things very seriously. I'll actually add on, having been involved in audits in my previous life as an auditor, as an exec, and saying that the attitude that we see is a very, very pleasing, it's a very, very pleasing one.
Can I just ask you to pause for a second just to address the concern from colleague Honorable Steele? It's my understanding that in the program that we will eventually present to the committee, one of the engagements we're going to have or set aside would be the presentation of the annual report of the Auditor General. I think at that point, the audited financial statements of the office could then be presented. I just need to double check that at what point and who should actually be presenting that to the committee, maybe as a point of clarity. Do you want to, the Auditor General, want to assist us? We're all new in this exercise.
Right. thanks very much, Chair. The annual report with the audited annual financial statements will be presented to the committee by ourselves, by the office. That will happen at the date that I think is been agreed already, the 11th of September. Initially, as I said earlier, that presentation of the financial statements and the annual report was meant to happen tomorrow. What it would have meant was that it would have been put through the tabling process in Parliament. We've already finalized it, the annual report is ready. We would table it in Parliament so that it becomes available to members for them to look at. And then we would then present it, we would have presented it tomorrow. But because of the fact that we couldn't get tomorrow, it then moved to September. So this briefing of the audit committee is really a briefing session in advance of us going to the detail of the annual financial statements, so that when members of the committee read through the financial statements of the office, they at least have an insight after having interacted with the audit committee on matters of governance, on matters of the independent evaluation that the audit committee would have done on those financial statements. So it's correct that those financial statements have not been presented to yourselves yet, but at least by the time they are, you at least would have had a good feel for how the independent audit committee sees the entire office in respect of issues of control, of governance, and all that. So we will be coming to the committee on the 11th as agreed, to then give you a presentation fully on the whole annual report, including the annual financial statements. But this context will also come in that process, because the report of the audit committee is also contained in the annual report.
Just to indicate.
Maybe I can also allude the meeting that a full report on the operations and the duties and responsibilities of the audit committee is also included in the annual financial statement. So you will have much more detail when you study the annual reports of the workings that we've done. But obviously the objective today is just to give you an overview and to tell you about the office itself and our relationship with the office, as well as the controls in the audit agenda as well.
Yeah, Chair. So that's in a nutshell. And the way that we've come to those conclusions, we meet very regularly, at least 3 to 4 times a year. We actually go through detailed reports. We've never been stopped asking any questions, no matter how uncomfortable they are, bearing in mind that all the members of the audit committee are all independent. None of us work for the government. None of us work for the auditor general's office. And even the way the remuneration is set, it's such that there isn't a dependence on the audit committee members on the remuneration from the auditor general's office, because it's important that we always are independent. And I can safely say that we've had absolutely no, we've never had any feeling that things were being withheld from us. Our scope has never been limited. And just maybe to put in context, because when the Deputy Auditor General said one of the members left because of potential conflict, there was, I just want to get the SCOAC to understand that there was absolutely nothing amiss. She's a chartered accountant, but she said in future she might actually be joining a firm that might do work for the Auditor General. So she actually just said for the future she needed, there was actually absolutely nothing nothing wrong. So we're set actually to see her go. Yeah, and we've always been independent. So that's maybe in a nutshell what happens. Our work is organized to look at detailed controls, review those, review the different operations, look at the areas of improvement. Possibly the single biggest thing that we had concerns with, and I think it's also fair to say maybe the office was actually more concerned about it before we even got consent, was actually the state of the finance office. We started a program, or the office started a program to clean that, and it's actually been going very, very well. In fact, all the results, both external and internal audit, has actually are pointing to marked improvements in the office. And it was really a program started by the office itself, and our job was actually to review that turnaround process. I don't know whether any of my members have got anything else to add on that before we get to questions.
In fact, maybe somebody can just clarify to us what was the exact nature of the problem with the finance office?
I can try, but I think Kim will do a better job than any of us.
Thanks, Chair. We're also going to go through this when we present our annual report, but what happened way back around 2007, there were a number of problems that were picked up in the manner in which the finance department in the office was capacitated. The leadership of that department was not up to scratch, to the extent that the office was exposed to a lot of risks pertaining to how finances of the office were managed. So we diagnosed the problem and put in place a project which we ran for a year and a bit, almost 2 years in fact, which we referred to as the Finance Turnaround Plan. The approach to it was to focus on tightening controls and bringing on board in the office people with the appropriate level of skills required to handle the finances of the office. We diagnosed this before things went wrong. So effectively, the last year and a half or two, we were presenting at every opportunity when the audit committee met our progress with regards to attracting the right level of skills, our progress with regards to the introduction of the appropriate controls. At that point, the person who was acting in the position of the chief financial officer was also under suspension due to matters pertaining to lack of competence in certain areas and some wrongdoing that was alleged with respect to that person who was heading the finance unit. But the matter was quickly concluded around the end of 2008, and that person was removed from the office, and we effectively got to a point as we speak now where we have predominantly a completely new leadership team in the finance area who have the right level of skills and with processes that support the work that they do. So that was effectively that finance turnaround plan. Nothing had actually happened to indicate that the office's financials were going to be qualified. It was a case of saying if we do not act on the issue of the lack of capacity as well as the improvement of controls, we might find ourselves in a situation where our finances would be not accurately reported and therefore may lead to a qualification. So that situation was resolved, and we are now running with those institutionalized processes with people with the right level of skills on board. As a result, the outcomes of that year's audit, together with this audit, among others, as the chair of the audit committee indicated, is a reflection of the stability that we have achieved over the time that we had to put in the finance turnaround plan.
And just before you add, a request came to me earlier as to whether at some point you'll make a briefing on the situation in the Northwest operation. I indicated that my understanding is that the matter is still under investigation, and obviously we wouldn't want that investigation to be jeopardized. But it's really your prerogative to first determine whether it would be ideal to do so at this stage, and secondly, the extent to which you would be in a position to share with the committee the state of affairs there, really would be entirely in your hands. But yes, you wanted, and maybe we can come back to that at the end of the presentation, if you so feel. But yeah, otherwise we can proceed with you.
Chair, I also, just in what the Deputy Auditor General said, I think it's important for the committee also to understand that all these things were actually picked up by the office itself under the leadership of the AG and the DAG. So it also tells us that the processes and procedures in the office actually are actually working. It's not something that they're under pressure from the auditors, under pressure from the audit committee, but the mere fact that the office itself could pick these things up, act on it, and our role was then also just to add our worth in whatever they were doing and also give some advice here and there. But we actually felt comfortable that the office could actually pick up these things and actually act, and act decisively and correctly.
Do I look like him?
Oh.
Jefferson.
The rich
people from the poor people.
Oh.
Jefferson, thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. No, there's a rich man, yes. Firstly, I think on behalf of some of my colleagues and I, we just want to apologize for having got in late when you had already started. There's a lot of traffic, and Cape Town's terrible when it comes to traffic. And this is why we arrived late. But just for us, I think my colleagues are just looking at documents in front of them, and my understanding is we don't have any document in front of us that we can refer to when the presentation is being made by the chair of the audit committee.
Are you in terms of a slide?
Yeah, there's nothing that I think we are. So, you know, all my colleagues are asking for that. I was even looking around. But my understanding is this is just an interaction, a meeting with the audit committee and getting to know what they do, like Professor Karen said, what you do and what you don't do. So I don't know if it's going to be appropriate for me to ask these questions, and if you think it's something that you can answer, well, please do so with the permission of the chairperson. You know, your
don't forget that I don't know if you've actually concluded your presentation yet. Because I thought you were at a certain point.
Yes, we were checking.
And you were checking whether the other office would want to add to what you had already covered.
Yeah, we're not.
But before I open it up, I need to clarify that point.
But it's also fair to say that, like I said, when we started this engagement, we were hoping that the committee would actually have seen the annual report, because we're really commenting on what contained in there, because our views are already in the report. We do have a report as part of the annual financial statement, so we didn't want to be, there was really no formal presentation as it was. I did say earlier on, with the permission of the chair, that we could also talk about how this committee would like to engage with the audit committee, because we had an understanding with the previous committee on how we engaged. We can share with you on that.
Can I just indicate that my understanding, and I think that's the understanding we got from the workshop last week, was that the annual report would be tabled today, and that in fact there is a process today to actually table it. The copies of the report are in possession of the secretary, the committee section, but they were cautious not to distribute when the formal tabling had not yet been done. So it's a bit, and for even if it's been circulated today, it would have been difficult for people to have a prior engagement with the report for purposes of preparing themselves for this meeting. They wouldn't have had the time to study it. I suppose it would have been ideal if you had prepared some slides, just so that, because in any case, this annual report is cumbersome for us politicians to go through all that fine print. So it's always good to have some notes in the form of slides or something that we can sort of, just to enable us to follow. But I guess you didn't plan it that way, so we will just have to proceed on the basis that you have prepared. You see, with last week, for example, the Aegis office actually prepared documentation that enabled the engagement to become a little easier. So even if the reports are there, we would still prefer going forward to have some kind of short summaries or notes that we can follow as you present. Let's just say going forward, that's the approach that we'll adopt. But on that note, I think we can proceed.
Chair, thanks. It's not yet. It's maybe the way that we've tended to do it in the past, that the committee will have read this, and it's essentially just maybe a very brief overview and then an engagement, but we'll do that going into the future. I just asked whether, before we take the questions, whether my colleagues had anything else to add before we get on to the second.
No, it was me. Myself.
Oh,
I'm
sorry.
No, I wanted just the clarity on the person that was suspended. If that particular person, I don't know whether we said that person was acting and that particular person was suspended. What was the reason of acting? Why was not the appointment made?
I mean, just to clarify, the person was actually an appointed chief financial officer. And after an investigation that took place with regards to the issues that were pointed out by the office on issues of competence, as well as some fiddling with the accounts, a disciplinary process was undertaken, which concluded that the office was within its rights to dismiss that employee. So that employee was dismissed. and is completely out of our system as of when the recommendation was made by the disciplinary chair. So it was a full-time employee who got subsequently suspended and dismissed.
That was concluded. All right. You can proceed. I think it's up to you to proceed to the next round. Oh, all right. So you, because the other one is unrelated. All right. Let's go back to you, Ms. Singh. You had the number of questions.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah. Like I said, this is an engagement, so I suppose it's not really pertinent. But I just would like to know the views of the audit committee on the appointment of external auditors to do the work within the office of the AG vis-a-vis them doing it themselves. We were told in the workshop there's about a 75-25. What is your views on that? Have you ever expressed a view? Have you thought about that particular split? Secondly, your views on not charging an administration fee whenever work is outsourced to private auditors, and then it is at a net loss to the Office of the Auditor General, although costs are incurred, in that process. Do you have any views on that, and have you expressed them before? The third view that I thought I'd like to know from you is the DAG has spoken about retention of staff and keeping capable staff within the Office of the AG. Is your views on the remuneration packages within the entire office, starting from the top to the bottom? Are the packages commensurate with the private sector? Can we retain staff? Things like that. The last one is the vacancy on the audit committee. Now, you were four, you're now three. What does the Act say? I mean, I haven't looked at the Act or anything. Is there any prescription that there should be four? Is there any intention to fill the fourth vacancy? And if so, what is that process? And the very last one, I think the AG did tell us last week that there was need for appointment of external auditors whose contract is coming to an end or has come to an end. And what are we going to do in that regard? Thank you, Chairman.
Well, I can just say the last question is the subject of the second part of their presentation. We're going to have an in-depth engagement on that specific issue. It's the most critical reason of their being here. So we're still coming to that. But just to add to the questions that have been asked, Ms. Still, do I see your hand as well?
Yeah. Another question, please.
All right. Let me just add one that's linked to what Ms. Singer just asked. And that is just the relationship of, maybe it's a separate question, a relationship between yourself as the audit committee and the audit function of the office, headed by, there's a lady that was introduced to us. What's her name again?
Gillian.
She had the audit function within the office. So I suppose flowing from that, there is some kind of a chain of command that links her to the audit activities and operations of the office, down to the many auditors that get deployed to do specific work all over. Vis-a-vis yourself as an independent audit committee that's outside of that structure. Who's who? If you could just clarify the kind of relations and the governance issues that are attendant to that. But you're not yet answering questions. Let's first get Mr. Steele to add his own feet of question.
I've actually only got one, Chair, but thank you very much. When the problems of the Northwest were announced, the Auditor General was quoted as having some very direct and pertinent things to say about the need for ethical standards and I commend him for those comments. They were very necessary for that to be said. But with that concern in the background, I'd like the Audit Committee just to comment on the special challenges and risks faced by the Auditor General's office in terms of the maintenance of those ethical standards, and whether this actually poses any particular or special challenges for the Audit Committee when it comes to addressing the risk analysis of doing this particular audit.
You may just want to elaborate a little more on your responsibilities. The issue of setting audit standards, for example, has just been raised. What's your specific role in that, if at all? And are there other related control systems that befall on you as an entity specifically that you're responsible for that we need you need to bring to the attention of the committee? All right.
Can I? Thank you. I'll ask the members of the committee also to chip in, and also the Auditor General. Let me start off with the question that you raised around the relationship between the audit committee and the audit function performed by Gillian. The audit function performed by Gillian is really around the work that the Auditor General does in the different audits of the entities under the audit of the Auditor General's office. So to that extent, she has got no reporting responsibility to us, but rather to the Auditor General, and we believe it ought to be like that, because the issue around auditing any entities that are the responsibility of the government in this parliament rests solely with the Auditor General, and we cannot ever be seen, even as the Audit Committee, to influence how the Auditor General conducts his work. And I think I am sure that the Auditor General will bear us out that it's actually something that, in fact, certainly for some of us, something that we don't necessarily even want to see, we don't even want to influence. We've actually spent a lot of time saying we need to make sure that the Auditor General is not influenced by anybody, not even by this committee. So Gillian has no reporting responsibility to this committee, because her function is not around auditing the office, it's auditing the entities in the office. However, there is an internal audit function that is responsible for auditing the office, the happenings in the office. They report into us. We have the responsibility for appointing them. So I don't know, Chair, whether that clarifies the point.
Well, it's very much that. In other words, you are the eyes, actually, of this committee.
Yes.
Your reports are more relevant to us than they are to SCOPA. The Auditor General's audit reports are more relevant to SCOPA than to us.
Yes.
So in a sense, I think that makes it even more sharp. All right. But insofar as the audit standards are concerned, do you have any role? Because that's the other part of the question.
No.
The audit standards insofar as Gillian's team go.
No. Again, in terms of the audit standards, as far as auditing the entities under the Auditor General has got to determine the scope of what has to be done without interference from anybody, and we don't even get involved with that. We only get involved in the scope of the external auditors who audit the office of the Auditor General that come to, in fact, the appointment is...
So everything that has to do with auditing the office itself. That's as far as you go. Anything beyond that, you don't get involved, in short. All right. Your colleague first, and then your other colleague. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. The audit of the Auditor General includes two aspects. There's also an audit done of performance indicators. And I think it would be true to say that we draw a high level of comfort that the Auditor General of South Africa is subject to quality control reviews similar to private audit firms. The IRBA, the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, does review the quality of the work done. So they're not reviewing the actual output or the reports that go to SCOPA, but they do review the underlying quality of the work done. And we draw considerable comfort from that.
Can I say we're going to go back to that issue based on what transpired at last week Friday's workshop with the chairs and whips, where a question related to that was raised, relating to situations where after the Auditor General has audited, further audits, I think forensic audits that get done, then reveal things that may not have been revealed during the initial general audit. I know that the Auditor General answered that quite comfortably, but I think it's important for this committee to take an interest in issues such as that and follow up on those issues. At the level of this forum, but your colleague, if you finish with your response, your colleague also wanted to chip in.
I'm just repeating what my colleague has said, but just to allude the meeting again, that the quality reviews being done on the work of the employers of the office who conducts the audit at the departments and so forth, we do get a report on the work done, and the quality review has been done by an external party. So we get assurance as an audit committee that the work that the Auditor General's
office does. Who is the external party that does that?
It's the RBA, the Independent Regulatory Body of Auditors. They're involved in it, and then they perform on it.
So they quality control all auditors in South Africa.
Well, that quality control all auditors in South Africa, obviously on a rotation basis, not all of them at once, but the Auditor General's office also has a system where specific responsible auditors are quality reviews are being done on the work that they perform. And the quality review committee then reports back to the audit committee and tells them whether the work performed by the Auditor General was of an acceptable quality. And I'm glad to report that the reviews for this year, for the past year, was of a high standard and favorable opinions were.
Maybe the office itself may want to comment on this specific issue around quality control in terms of your audit work.
Chair, it will be part of the next session under the review of the audit process. Yeah, we've reserved that for that session. Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, Chair, I actually wanted to say that it's also important that we note it because it's actually outside of our scope what actually happens in the audits. Of we actually just look at it purely in terms of the effectiveness of the office, because again we can't start talking about what the auditors have to do, because that's the remit of the Auditor General, and we can't as this committee influence that.
But I think we just wanted to get a sense that you were saying that in fact your colleague, how it arose that part of what you do relates to the auditing of
performance of the author.
Now, the performance, then, we understood it to relate to the actual quality of the product that comes from the author.
Yes.
So we just wanted clarity there, because it seems to be...
No, it's valid that in terms of the performance audits, the auditors, both external and internal, will look at the performance, how the office is performing. All I was saying is that when it comes to the issues of how they audit, we can give you assurance that it's actually been reviewed, the result has been good. However, how...
Independent regulatory...
Yes, but however, the actual issues on the audit and what they ought to be doing, it's really the issue for the Auditor General, not of this committee, because the moment this committee actually starts talking about what sort of things the Auditor General needs to be putting in place in terms of auditing and that kind of thing, we have actually started crossing the line, because he must actually act in an independent manner. We can only talk about how the office functions, not how the audits are conducted. We can't even talk about what sort of processes, procedures need to be in those audits. It's not our remit. We can talk about the systems and the procedures on the audit of the office, not of the entities. Because if we do that, we're actually starting to mess around with the constitutional provisions.
For my clarity, I accept that the committee does not in any way influence the AG, but for my clarity, how do we define influence, broadly or narrowly?
I will, through you, Chair, I'd like to say that it is the view of this committee in terms of influencing the scope of the work of the Auditor General. We should actually have zero influence. Because we actually start messing around with the independence of the Auditor General. It should actually be totally non-existent. And I like to think that, in fact, all of us have been on the committee for the same period when the Auditor General was still the DAG. I think he can actually safely say that we have not even tried to do that. In fact, it was interesting. One of the things that we had to spend some time talking about Auditor General, you might maybe 2 years ago when we were talking even about the advisory board to the audit committee, and he said, you can't regulate that, he must have advisors, because the moment he has advisors, somebody is going to ask, did you take their advice? Because as this committee, we actually felt that we shouldn't even have that thing enshrined anyway, because if the Auditor General wants to speak to somebody for his own views, he should be allowed, but he must not be forced to talk to anybody on how he does that. So we feel very, very strongly about it, that it should actually be zero. And in fact, I have never, even as the chairman, actually just asked about how the audits are. We've actually, when we've had issues that some of the offices are not functioning properly in terms of how the office ought to function, we have had an interest, but we never talk about the audits.
Chairman?
Yes.
Just to add to that, our chair mentioned the Constitution. The Auditor General is a Chapter 9 institution in terms of the Constitution, and his independence is enshrined in the Constitution. So if we did anything to try and influence that, we would be totally out of line in terms of the Constitution. I'd also like to add another aspect, and it's something that I touched on when I attended the...
Before you step off that, I just want to indicate that the Constitution in Chapter 9 refers to two separate concepts, and we talked about that in last week's workshop. It requires the Auditor General to do two things separately. One is to report to Parliament, at least once a year. That would relate to reporting on whatever findings that the Auditor General make in relation to the discharge of its mandate, constitutional mandate. One would assume that essentially relates to the audit function that the Auditor General performs on all the entities that the Auditor General is supposed to audit. Now, those reports, from a parliamentary point of view, all go to a body called SCOPA. Right? And, of course, the different portfolio committees that are responsible for the specific line functions that may be the subject of the audit, all right? So that further oversight functions of Parliament can be carried out in relation to those entities that have been audited by those respective committees, by way of follow-up, by way of calling those entities to come and explain things that arise out of the report and the findings in those reports of the Auditor General. That is a stream of work all on its own. So your explanation says to us that insofar as that is concerned, it is the exclusive purview of the Auditor General.
Yep.
All right? It's a relationship that then exists between the Auditor General and Parliament, right, through SCOPA as the entry point. The second stream of work, which is quite separate, that also draws from the Constitution itself, it says that the Auditor General is accountable, not just the Auditor General, Chapter 9 institutions are accountable to Parliament. All right. Now, what that means is that not only is the Auditor General required by the Constitution to present his findings to Parliament for further action, he is also required, or the office is also required, to subject the Crown to Parliament for purposes of reporting on itself as to its own performance as an office, right? Of course, there you also then have structures such as yourself, such as the independent auditor, who must then look at the operations of the Auditor General, look at the financials of the Auditor General, and report on that. And that then becomes the tools that becomes available to Parliament, for Parliament to then exercise oversight on the Auditor General as an office. All right? Now, to that extent, your role is the subject of discussion now, in aiding Parliament in the performance of its oversight function. And that is the subject. So in that context, you see, it becomes critical for the committee to be clear as to how you understand your responsibility in this regard. All right? And your understanding as to how far your responsibility goes. All right? So I just thought it's important for us to get that clear distinction. You want to follow up on that?
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think another way of bringing home that point is to explain that our interface as the Audit Committee is with the DAG. We don't actually interface with the AG. And the DAG is responsible for the operations of the office. So that's why we deal with him. Yes, the AG does on occasion sit in on meetings, but his he's not required to be at the meetings of the Audit Committee. The other thing that I would like to add, and I did mention at the previous meeting that I attended with this SCOAC, is that not only is the Auditor General South Africa rated on a par with the large private firms in South Africa, it has done that against a background where it is probably the most significant contributor to transformation within the accountancy profession in South Africa. They set very strict targets for themselves in terms of historically disadvantaged individuals, and they rate very highly on that. And I think the office is to be commended on that achievement. And I think they serve as a shining example within the new South Africa.
I'll come to the DAG in a second, but I just wanted as a follow-up to that to say that's the kind of stuff we're interested in. We're interested in understanding what is it exactly that you're looking at when you call yourself the audit committee. What are the key things that you look at in the discharge of your own functions, putting aside the role of the Auditor General office itself, which is defined in the Constitution? So our engagement would be to try and suss out more from yourself in terms of your own kind of responsibility, now that we have an opportunity to interact with yourself. But the DAG wants to say something.
Thank you, Chair. Just letting on your point on the two issues that we also dealt with last week regarding the requirement for report two and accountable two, just to bring additional perspective to this. If one looks at the report two, certainly these matters pertaining to the audits that we do, as you correctly indicated, Chair. Now, if one looks at the audit committee in relation to the accountable two part of the requirement of the Constitution, one would argue that SCOAC is at the center of that, of the accountable two. But the sources of assurance to enable SCOAC to apply itself on the accountable two are coming from two angles. The one angle is directly from the Auditor General in his capacity as the Auditor General. And that one is with respect to issues of, let's say, auditing standards. The Auditor General would come to SCOAC annually to present the standards to which we are going to audit. And those standards affect the report too. And the audit committee is not involved in issues pertaining to development of standards to which we will audit, because they are about the report too. And that's why the Auditor General brings them directly to SCOAC. When it comes to issues of stewardship, on the issues of the assets of the organization, the activities of the organization, insofar as is the organization being managed and controlled appropriately. Those are the issues that the audit committee deals with directly with the Deputy Auditor General. And so the standing committee on the AG will get a source of assurance on the operations of the office, excluding issues like auditing standards. Those will come through to SCOAC via the audit committee, who work directly with the Deputy Auditor General as the head of administration of the office, to reinforce the need for the SCOAC to play oversight on the accountable two element of this. And issues of auditing standards, if, for example, we said we are going to increase the scope of work that we do in all the departments in the state because of whatever risks that have been identified, that doesn't find its way through to the audit committee. It comes directly from the AG to the committee. So I thought perhaps those two levers which support SCOAC are quite important to separate, so that what we are dealing with here in terms of the audit committee is to reflect on issues of stewardship, on issues of control that is in place in the office, to make sure that the office does not slip into a situation where it might end up having a negative opinion, which will impact negatively on the ability of the Auditor General to strengthen the report to element of what is required in the Constitution. I think that's probably one of the issues to just clarify better what the chair of the Audit Committee was saying.
Can I just, I know Honorable Sosibo also wants to make a follow-up. Did I see your hand?
I was just about to raise my hand before the
meeting. All right. Oh, so he's covered you. But I just wanted to say something else as a rider to everything that we've been saying here. And that is the fact of the term of the word independent, all right? It features in the Constitution in a number of respects with regard to the courts. It features with regard to the prosecuting authority, I think, which is a Chapter 8 institution. It features in respect of Chapter 9 institutions and a number of other entities specifically mentioned in the Constitution. I think we as Parliament would understand that that term also applies to us, that even though we may have the responsibility to hold certain entities accountable, or for that better, have the powers to appoint or recommend appointment of certain entities, have the powers to remove or recommend the removal of certain entities, all those should not be exercised in the manner that compromises the independence referred to in the Constitution of those entities. So neither us or SCOPE could go so far as to impede on the actual independence of the office to be able to discharge its constitutional mandate. So there is a delicate balance that we also have to maintain in the way that we exercise our own constitutional mandate of receiving reports or of holding the office accountable, so to speak. But you wanted to come through?
Yeah. Now, just how we conduct, because our duty is also in terms of the public auditors, and it talks about when we must meet, but it's clear that the audit committee must, in the annual report referred to in section 41, comment on the effectiveness of internal controls, its evaluation of the Auditor General's annual financial statements, and may communicate any concerns. And how we do this, before we concern ourselves on how the program of the internal auditors is set, we ask ourselves the question, are they covering all the important areas? Are they covering the areas that we believe are risky? We also look at the program of the external auditors and ask ourselves whether they are concerning themselves with all the important issues, and we ask the questions we meet, like the Act says, at least 3 times a year. We go through a detailed program where we get all these reports and make sure that even the conduct of their duties, they are not impeded at all. At every meeting, we always afford both the internal and external auditors, if they do have any concerns on their scope, to meet with us privately. As the chairman of the committee, I'm also always available to meet with them should they ever have so. We do give them even the opportunity to meet with us without management every time. So that's actually how we conduct our duties. I'll move on, Chair, to the other
questions. Questions on this leg, because we're now moving into the other area of our engagement today. Yes, Josh.
Thank you, Chair. My apologies for being late. I just want to clarify something.
In the previous workshop, the issue was raised that there are times where the Auditor General staff does not get access to senior people in departments, for example. And to my mind, that must impede in some way the ability to generate a quality output, possibly. Is that something, for example, that the Audit Committee looks at? Because what you're saying is that obviously you're looking at various areas that are covered, etc. But I think that's a quality issue, and it's not necessarily a standard either. So I don't know what would happen there. Thanks, Chair.
Chair, can I?
I have it here, but let me first hear you.
Chair, because that is now going into the work that's being carried out by the Auditor General. It's actually not it's not part of the scope of the Audit Committee. I think it's something that the Auditor General can cover when he talks about the activities of
in the fact, I think we'll defer that matter to the next leg, which is the continuation of the exercise that we had last week, because the issue did, in fact, arise from the presentation of the Auditor General himself, and also from the workshop that we had with the Chairs and Whips last week. So the issue is, remember, one of our mandates relates to protecting the independence or promoting the independence and effectiveness. So to the extent that the independence or effectiveness is being impeded by factors that are external to the Auditor General itself as an office, that's where our role comes to question as Parliament, not just as this committee, to say what measures are we putting in place as an institution to make sure that such impeding, you know, is not perpetuated. But those are some of the things that we can engage further when we come to. I think for now we want to confine ourselves to the role specifically of the Audit Committee, which is a much narrower a role than some of us may have thought before this engagement. All right?
Chair, then going to the question on our views on the split of the work between the work contracted to outside firms, I think, Mr. Singh, that was your question, and the work that the office itself does, and maybe attendant to that, the question of the fees. As a starting point, the way that the Auditor General splits his work, how he chooses to do it, it actually goes on to the point that we've been saying earlier on, that it is not the remit of our body, the Audit Committee, to worry about what it does. If, however, it was actually something that was procedural in the office, within the office procedures, that this is going to be done that way, we will concern ourselves with that. But it's not a it's actually, he must actually determine that. And so our view, quite frankly, is not important, and we don't necessarily worry about that, because it's actually in the way that he carries out his work, because it's up to him to determine whether he needs external assistance, if he needs other people, if he feels. So it's actually that one point we don't. In terms of the fees do, we do have some opinions on that, because that actually talks to the functioning of the audit. And I think it might be maybe a bit premature for us to raise that until the office has taken you through what their funding module is going to be. I'm right, Timmy, that there is the office is going to be taking the committee through that presentation. With your permission, Chair, can I ask that you listen to the presentation from the office, and when they've done that, if there are questions, in fact, I was going to say, it actually looks like
a session at some point that's going to look at the fee structure.
Yeah.
And would engage on that level. I'm not sure who then leads that. That would be the Auditor General himself.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't want to.
So I think that we can reserve for another occasion.
I was going to say that, well, I'll come to that right there. Then there was a question around the retention of staff and the remuneration. For us, the retention of staff and the remuneration is actually more around the control consciousness and the effectiveness of the office, because to the extent that the office cannot fill all the vacancies, to the extent that the office is not hiring people that are of a certain caliber, it might actually reduce or increase the risk in the office. So we do have concerns about it, and when I say we do have concerns, we're happy with the way that the office has dealt with, but we do exercise our minds on that. In fact, in the finance turnaround plan, one of the things that was actually so glaring was the number of vacancies, and we even asked that they report to us on how those vacancies are filled, how quickly they are, because if you actually, my simple analysis of the office and I dare say chair is actually a very, very simple analysis, is that it's actually people and the IT systems. So for the office to actually work properly, it's actually got to have the right caliber of people, the right kind of systems. Those are the things that we concern ourselves with. On the remuneration side, although all of us have got strong opinions, the office does have a remuneration committee that actually concerns itself with that. I have heard, and I to state that it's purely a privilege, that from time to time, the DAG will actually ask that I give some input onto that, but purely from a risk point of view. So there is a committee that deals with that, and I think it will be wrong for me to assume that role. But I mean, like I said, we always say we need to always think that the way that we offer salaries enables us to attract the right kinds of people. You ask the question, I can tell you my view. I actually think that particularly this office and the nature of the work that it does, our view has been that we possibly need a slightly different mindset, because we actually need high caliber people in terms of making sure that we're able to keep the quality of our Auditor General and the quality of our Deputy Auditor General. We can't really have a situation where we have people that actually just go there because they've got nowhere else to go. It's actually very important that they want to do those jobs. So, I mean, we do have opinions, but it's outside. On the vacancy, on the audit committee, I think the Act says at least 3 members. Yeah, so we are 3. We have actually made proposals on actually maybe just making sure that in actual fact, there are more than 3, because the moment right now, because there are 3 of us, if one of us misses a meeting, it's actually difficult to conduct a proper meeting. So we've got a process that's going on. The question of external auditors, like the chair said, it's the subject of our next item on the agenda, and I would like to defer to that. I don't know whether there is anything that my colleagues want to add on.
I don't know whether, in a sense, you're saying that the two separate issues in relation to Mr. Singh's question around the 70-30 or 80-20 split between internal and external auditors to do the actual audits on entities. The one level relates to that situation possibly arising unintendedly because of a certain degree of vacancy rate at a given point in time that might occur, which I think would then be your responsibility and your concern to be on the lookout for and to advise the Auditor General on. That is, the staffing levels, insofar as they relate to the capacity of the office to discharge its core function. The other side to it relates to a deliberate margin that is set at a conceptual level to say, for the purposes of maintaining the right balance, we will deliberately ensure that we set a norm that says at least 80% of the people who do the audit come from within the office and the remaining 20% come from outside. So that's a separate issue, which perhaps you would, if I understand you correctly, would be a matter that is beyond you as a committee. So maybe just want to clarify that and confirm if you want to, because then it means that that part would then be the subject of our further engagement with the office directly.
Yeah, that whole part, Chair, I believe that it's the subject of your next deliberation.
You want to add something before?
Thank you, Chair. Just to perhaps expand a little bit on what our Chair has reported to the committee. In terms of the Public Audit Act, the AG's financial statements have to include performance against predetermined objectives, and the external auditors have to report on the achievement of those predetermined objectives. One of the predetermined objectives is that the AG needs to meet the deadlines laid out for it in terms of the Audit Act. So while we would not be in a position to dictate to them whether they should do the work themselves or contract work out, if they fail to meet the deadlines and if that becomes pervasive within the organization, that gets reported in the annual financial statements and the auditors report on that. And that then becomes a level of concern for us, because we do review, but part of our mandate in terms of the Audit Act is to review the financial statements. Similarly, they deal with issues of retention of staff. They set targets for themselves. If they fail miserably against those targets, then that would be a level of concern for us. And we would turn to the DAG and we would say, you need to put a plan in place to address this and report back to us on the success of your plan.
But obviously the detail of that we'll get when we get to engage with the annual report itself and the annual financial statement. All right. On that note, I think we can then proceed to deal with the subject. Yes? All right. Okay.
I think the Northwest question has got two separate issues. One which is around the audit itself, which is a separate issue. In terms of the special challenges, the responsibilities and the risks, we will concern ourselves with that because it actually starts affecting the functioning of the office. I do not have all the full details, but suffice to say that when this issue did arise and the office was going to take some action, the Deputy Auditor General called me aside and said, look, there are going to be these issues, we are going to be dealing with them, and until we've actually had a much fuller report, I think it's also premature to comment on it. But those things generally will then affect us, because we do worry about the controls in the office. We do worry about the conduct of the employees of the Auditor General. It's not only the risk in terms of the controls in the office, but also the ability for the office to conduct its work in an independent manner. I mean, this also actually hits right across the issue of how people could actually do their work independently when they're meant to be independent. So that actually does actually affect us. But more importantly, in terms of, because this committee's role is to look at the function of that office, notwithstanding the fact that we said we don't work, we don't want to influence what the Auditor General does. The perceptions of this office, we can't pretend that if there are negative perceptions around the office, it has an overflow on what the people think happens in the office of the Auditor General. So one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about is how we maintain and uphold the reputation of the office of the Auditor General. So in our minds, we always worry about the reputation of the office, and we spend a lot of time talking about it, and we've actually said as a committee, it's important for the DAG to keep on drumming to people that whatever they do, you see, if somebody says there is fraud in the office of the Auditor General, they're going to ask how then you're actually going to do the audit. So those are some of the things that actually overflow, and we do spend a lot of time talking about chair. So that's actually how, and therefore the in terms of the responsibilities of this committee in
but
terms
you,
of
you don't monitor the control measures that are put in place to minimize risk
yes, we do.
At an operational level.
Yeah, we do. In fact, we've actually said if there are any offices in terms of their operations, not how they audit, that are a problem, we've actually said we'll ask the Deputy Auditor General to hold those people to the Audit Committee. And in fairness, I think right across we've generally seen an improvement.
We then proceed.
Okay. Chair.
Chair, I'm not used to. And Chair, the next issue is around the appointment of the external auditors. I have not attended some of the meetings, so maybe if I'm saying something that you already know, just indicate them. I won't say it. We've had one firm auditing, doing the external audit of the office for the last 10 years. We agreed with the previous committee that it will be good to rotate auditors, because to have the same firm for a long period of time might not be necessarily a good thing. The previous chair, when we started this engagement, we went and looked at what was how listed entities do, and we came to a figure of 10 years, and I'll ask that this committee reconfirm that, because we said no firm can therefore do the audit of the Auditor General's office for more than 10 years. So in choosing the auditors, the incumbents are therefore definitely out. So even when they put in a proposal, we didn't even look at it, because we're actually working on that basis. We've also included in that, said that...
Is there a legal prescript or any other prescript, or is it something that is up to us to set a norm for?
There is no legal prescript. It's entirely up to you. Although in terms of good practice, at least you have to rotate the audit partners. There are some countries that actually try to rotate. In South Africa, you don't have to rotate the audit firms, although a lot of people think it's a good practice. But that's why you ended up with that term, because you also have to start balancing the need for continuity and less disruption, because if you're going to be having generally the size of this entity, by the time you really get into the full swing, I'll contend that you need probably at least 2 to 3 years before you actually understand everything fully for you to perform an audit. That's actually quite acceptable. So you need a longer period, but it's entirely up to you. At this point in time, we're working on 10 years. We're also working on a partner rotation. I think we'll also then require them to rotate the partner purely from an independence point of view, because there's a view that if a partner is on one job for too long, you can actually become one too cozy with the management team, or you actually become too familiar with things that you actually don't see some of the things that you ought to be seeing, which actually impedes your effectiveness. But it's entirely up to you. Right now we're working on 10 years. So there was also another.
So the current firm has done 10 years.
Yes, the current firm. In fact, their term came to an end at the conclusion of this audit, which is actually going to be the financial statements, which are going to be the subject of the review. So their term has come to an end. So if this committee still holds the view that we don't ever extend, the time is now for us to be chosen.
What do you mean their term has come to an end? How long are their terms?
They've done 10 years.
I'm saying, is it 5-year term?
No. It's an annual appointment.
So immediately they present their audit statement, their term.
So there is a process that every year
there is a renewal.
But what we've said is
a renewal for up to how long? That's the issue.
Yes. And I mean, our proposal is that when you talk now about the norm, it's not normal at all in South Africa or anywhere in the world to be appointing auditors for less than something like 3 to 5 years, because really, when you get new auditors, you only get, because particularly you as parliamentarian, you get the better advantage from them if they've actually understood it, and I reckon that
they must understand over a period
of 3 years. So my suggestion, or this committee's suggestion, is that you don't look at, although annually we have to look at it, just rely on us to come to, if we do have concern, of course even after 1 year we'll come to you and say we think we ought to be changing. But generally,
obviously the annual thing helps us in the event that we're not happy with their performance as such, that we can change our minds and get another firm even before the lapse of the 10-year period.
Yes, but also the other thing, professionally, I think it's still the case, I've not been in the profession for about 12 years, before a new auditor accepts an appointment, so if we also just change auditors because we think we're trying to protect ourselves, a new firm of auditors must ask the previous auditor whether there is any reason why they should not accept the appointment. So there's also a check that we are not wanting to do things incorrectly ourselves. So the process now that we're talking about is premised on that understanding.
Ask the reason. So yeah. We will check. Ask the reason from who? From the audit standards?
No. If, for example, right now...
From the previous audit firm.
Right now there is BDO, Spencer, and they are the outgoing auditors. The firm that we appoint, professionally, they must actually ask BDO, I like to think that BDO, Spencer will say, they must accept the appointment, because the only reason why we're changing BDO is because their term has come up, nothing else. But I mean, if we're actually saying that there is a lot of fraud and we want him to cover up, BDO, Spencer must actually say to the new auditor that, well, there is a reason why you must not accept it, because the office or the auditor general or parliament is trying to hide these things.
That audit firms can actually blacklist you.
Yeah, almost. In fact, one of the things that audit firms must actually do is, because if we're an organization that's rife with fraud and that kind of thing, it actually raises their own risks. So they might actually, in fact, turn out as a partner if we actually thought we're dealing with people that were crooked who refused to do their audits. Because
I just want to check that if we go according to the proposal of 10 years, are you saying the annual one, there will be a commitment to this new firm to say annually you get the contract, but there will be a commitment for 10 years? Or how do you do it? Do we just a gentleman agreement?
No.
How do you do it?
In fact, we've not necessarily discuss this issue, but I'm sure the members of the committee might. We would rather look at, after 5 years, Chair, actually look at a proper, maybe doing a full review. Am I right? But I mean, it's about 5 years that this committee will like to do a full review, but annually we will exercise our minds. Annually, we'll exercise our minds to say, do we still want to carry on with this firm? So there is absolutely no guarantee. However, I think what you might be calling the gentleman's agreement is that if they are doing their work properly to our satisfaction, we will not necessarily be coming to this committee before 3 years to say, can we look at changing? Definitely not before 3 years, I can actually say that.
I think the professor wanted to add
something. One should also realize that any audit firm knows that they're only appointed for a year. You know, so if they have expectations that the appointment will be longer than a year, obviously they hope for it, but the appointment is only for a year. So it's up to this committee to decide on a yearly basis to reappoint the auditors. But what we're saying is we as an audit committee, if there's no reason for us to make a recommendation to change the auditor, the term will be from 5 to 10 years as normal practice has been up there.
But Honourable Ndabandaba, first and then
it's a comment just to say that in my view, it is a very good business policy to rotate external auditors.
Mr. Singh?
Chairperson, thank you. Just to get the understanding from what you're saying. Every year you call for auditors.
No.
Will you advertise every year?
No.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. So at the end of the year, if I'm
you
successful this
only if you actually are considering changing.
But if I'm successful this year, there's an option to renew. There will be an option to renew in my contract with you.
No, it's not that policy.
What is the term of appointment of an auditing company?
The in every aspect, even in normal companies, their auditors are appointed for a year. But if every year you then say, we want to reconfirm that appointment, so we don't go through any other process, what we'll do, because in terms of the Act, you as SQUAD have to appoint annually. And the way that we've operated with SQUAD is on our advice. So annually we'll come to you and say, we recommend that we continue with that firm. That's the normal thing. But maybe after 5 years, we might actually say, look, let's actually just go out in the market again. Those people that are, and they will then go through a full process, like we're going through now, going to Honorable Ndabanda to say, we need to, it's a good policy, and we're comfortable with that. It's actually just that it's not an easy, when I say not an easy process, because the office must actually get used to them. They've got to get used to the office. And for you to express an opinion on the functioning of the office, you need to be comfortable that it's been done properly. As the audit committee, we need to be comfortable that it's done properly.
Now, I think if you look at the constitutions of most organization, if you look at the articles and memoranda of association of corporate entities, you would almost invariably find a clause that says that one of the agenda items at the annual general meeting is the appointment of auditors. So it becomes incumbent on the AGM to actually, having received a financial statement and having deliberated, make a decision whether to reappoint the same firm or to appoint a different firm. So that, in actual fact, is a check and balance to make sure that if, upon looking at the very same audit you're looking at for that year, you have questions about the manner in which the auditors conducted their work, given the critical role that the audit plays in the overall governance of the entity, to be able to say, and not be to be tied down. So even with your contractual commitments, they may not exceed that period, so that you enjoy that flexibility. But I think that is a given. The issue really is whether we want to then develop a norm, not a rule, but a norm, to the effect that we set a maximum period to which you can renew, annually renew that contract, and possibly set a minimum. In this case, possibly say a minimum of 5 years, a maximum of 10 years, which is the time frame within which you expect to look at whether you want to actually maintain the same and renew the contract with the same auditing firm, taking into account the issues he's raised of too long a period of time and too cozy a relationship potentially developing. We're dealing with perception more than fact. In fact, in the case of fact, obviously you'd have to act instantly. But we're dealing more with the issue of perception. Mr. Singh, Mr. Long.
Yeah, Chairperson, personally I have no problem with the reappointment of an auditor on the advice of the audit committee to STOEC on an annual basis. No problem with that. But I think what we need to decide as a committee, what Mr. Moyo said, is the rider. There's got to be a rider that no firm will be appointed for a period of X consecutive years. At the moment, it's 10. The last committee said 10. So no firm will be appointed for a period of longer than 10 consecutive years. Is that what it is? Yeah. We'll have to apply our minds there, whether 10 is reasonable or 5 or 8 or 6 or whatever. And then to apply our minds in that regard, we'll have to, listen to the advice of the audit committee. I mean, is 10 reasonable? Or is 5, should we after 5 years, say, go back to the market? That's the kind of argument you need to put before us now. So that
can I just indicate that, in fact, I'm not even sure whether a SCOC we can set a rule to any effect. I think we're more dealing with a factual situation. This firm has been there for 10 years. That's what is before us. So I think rather than exhausting our minds on an attempt to set a rule, which we won't even be there when that rule is put up for, I mean, a future SCOEC may say, that's a stupid rule, or no, we're not interested even in looking at it. They won't be bound by it because it's not up to us as SCOEC to set rules. I think the issue really is we now have a firm that served for 10 years. We are in a position to consider a reappointment. One of the considerations that we may have to take into account in making a decision whether to renew this specific appointment or to substitute it with a new one would be to look at the time that this independent audit firm has been serving in this regard. And the fact that they have served for 10 years would be a factor
that influence us or the audit committee's recommending, that that should be one of the criteria that we use in making that choice. I think that's the best way to interpret it.
Chair, can I say I differ on that? Because let me say why I differ with that view. Because I think you need to give us that as a rule. Because the terms on which we ask the firm to tender, if DTO meets that all those criteria better than anybody else, it's difficult for us to say no. And but if you see, that's actually why we went to SCOAC and we actually set it as a rule from SCOAC. That's why my preference as the chairman of this committee is that we set it as a rule, because then we've got a leg to stand on. Right now, if we actually just say we, in fact, I was there when the tenders were opened. The BDO Spencer Stewart, we didn't even look at. We put aside, because in terms of the rules, they were disqualified. And that's actually why it's important for us to actually...
I don't want us to belabor this issue that much. I know that colleagues also want to comment on this. All I want to say, in very simple terms, is that conceptually there's a fundamental difference between a norm, a practice, and a rule. A rule generally relates to something that's laid down in the law that binds you legally. There may be a contractual commitment that has been entered into. It has almost the effect of a rule, because the breach thereof constitutes a legal violation anyway, as if it's written in the law. Contract is another way of making rules. That is very different from what other people call a gentleman's understanding, a norm, a practice, where everybody understands that things will be done that way, but there's nothing that's binding. So I think it's critical for us to distinguish between these different concepts, because if you appoint a firm on the basis that there is a rule, which rule does not exist, and then somebody decides not to follow that rule, and only to find that in fact there wasn't a rule, that firm may feel that it's been misled into believing that there is a firm commitment that can be enforced when in fact it cannot be. So I'm just saying, whatever we recommend, whatever we agree to, let's not fudge the concept, because the concepts have legal implications. And legally, the fundamental distinction in terms of the binding nature of things and their legal implications in general. So that's all I'm trying to emphasize. Unless the recommendation was, let's amend the Audit Act and put in a provision, which would be tricky, of course, because there is already a provision that says, in law, a firm is appointed for only a year. All right? That is the law. That is the rule. But the practice or the norm would be to renew that contract according to the amount of length of time that is deemed to be reasonable, taken into account, or taking into account some of the issues that we've raised.
Chair, yes. I still, you see, this is a public entity, and I mean, I serve on another board where we've actually spent a lot of time with people making allegations that things, contracts have not been appointed properly. The reason why, and I'll tell you, we've worked with it as a rule, just like when I come to the other criteria, we've actually, even though it's not written down, we're happy to actually advertise it so that everybody knows, because the rules, they don't have to be. We can actually say, because we are allowed to set the criteria, but that criteria must be transparent. Everybody needs to know. Therefore, if we say your fees can't be, the fee that you're charging here can't be more than 10%,
That's the rule. And we're going to disqualify people on it. Everybody knows. But I'm saying we can't disqualify somebody on something which is actually not applicable. So whether we call it a rule, I mean, we have worked as this committee as a rule because we set it up with the previous scorework. That's why I said, let's actually start on that basis, because if we're not agreed on that basis, then we'll actually have to change the names of the firms that we are looking at. We actually put it as a hard and fast rule, just like there are certain rules here that we are discussing. We're not even discussing the 10-year rule because we dealt with it as a rule, and it was done. We thanked BDO Spencer. We told them that we're not going to consider them. I said to the partner, you know the rules, you're comfortable with it. And I mean, if this committee says it's not the rule, we're also fine with it. But then we have to consider BDO.
Maybe you didn't understand the point. And I don't want us to belabor it at the risk of losing time in terms of the actual process. All I was saying is that there are certain things that are binding in law, and for them to be binding in law, they must be couched in a particular manner or be contained in particular instruments. All right? Whether it's a contract, that's why there is such a concept called contract, or whether in an act of parliament, that's why there is such a thing called a law. As opposed to, for example, a norm or a practice where there is common understanding that this is how we do things without that necessarily being made or given the force of law. There's a fundamental distinction in law between those two. That's the only point I was making. But let me first entertain hands from that side, and then I'll come down to this side. Let me start with Honorable Zadie.
I've got a small proposal. Can we do us a favor as COEC with the committee there, that we confine ourselves to the rules or other way we can name? If we can say, let's confine ourselves to the previous roles which is square, and then the committee had before us, that after 10 years, and then we say, no, if one firm was appointed for more than 6 years or so, up to 10 years, we confine ourselves to the so that now, this is the one we told them that we will never consider you. We stick to that arrangement. We know that we get now the commendation from you that we have shortlisted so many firms, and then we recommend this one. And then we will deal with it, with that one, for the chair. Instead of going deeper into the rules and all that. I just the proposal from the chair.
Was there anybody else who wanted to comment on this? All right. Dr. John,
thank you, Chairperson. I think what is given is, on an annual basis, a decision needs to be made whether the contract is for the same firm is going to remain or not. So every year it's looked at. So I think it doesn't matter whether it's called a rule or anything like that, but there is criteria that gets applied. So obviously the criteria, every year there's certain criteria, i.e. they performed well, they know the business, and we want to keep them, so on you go. One of the criteria could also be is that after 10 years, we should actually not reappoint them because they've been around for so long. So I agree it needs to be transparent, but perhaps we don't call it a rule. We just call it a set of criteria that we've agreed that need to apply so that you don't get contractual problems. You know, you promise to keep me, whatever. We have criteria, and every year we can actually decide. So, you know, I think that would be a good way to go, and I would support the 10-year thing.
Can I just say that was my starting point when this whole thing was started, and we're back to exactly where I started. I'm saying that the law or the rule All right. Yeah. Again. I happen to be chairing. Sorry about that. Again, the law or the rule that's written in the Act, which is similar to the rule that's written in constitutions of all kinds of organizations, is that once a year, the board or the annual general meeting, or in this case, COAG, must make an appointment. That is the rule. The norm that has been agreed by the previous COAG is that we shall renew, in exercising that rule, we shall renew appointments every year for a maximum period of 10 years. All right? And I further suggested that maybe a suggestion in passing was being made that a good practice should be to also set a minimum, to say ideally the renewal should not be for less than a period of 5 years, so that you allow the firm to gel in with the issues and the dynamics over time that arise in that particular institution. All right. He accurately reflected what I was proposing, that in appointing the firm every year, we could have as one of the criteria the fact that we've committed ourselves to certain norms, one of which is that the general practice is to retain the same firm for a period of up to a maximum of 10 years. Since in this year's appointment, we are in fact confronted with that question, that we're dealing with a firm that's already served a period of 10 years, it is an opportune time to actually apply that norm, not that rule, that norm. All right? So that's essentially, in short, what we're saying from the very beginning. Okay? And that's basically how the matter is concluded. But can you then proceed to deal with the actual issue?
So, having done that,
we then started a process, and we're now at a point where it's actually become quite urgent, because at the next meeting, I think around about September, October, the new firm must actually start the audit for the next financial year, because as we stand right now, the office does not have an appointed auditor. We then went through a process. The other thing that the previous, in fact, part of the tenure thing, there was a feeling that we also needed to give more people opportunities, and also the disadvantaged firms. That actually what drove that thinking at the time. So we then went away and set some criteria for appointing the auditors. We actually tried to change the auditors in the previous cycle. We ended up with the same auditors. And the cycle that we had, it's important for the external auditors to be independent. So we said we have to appoint a firm of auditors which is independent. We looked, to the members there by the. No. We said we needed to look at the independence criteria. I mean, the obvious thing that they can't be working for the office, but they must also not be doing any other work for the office of the Auditor General, because if they are doing any work in the office, their independence might be impaired. We also looked at the level of fees. The general norm in the auditing profession to determine the level of independence relative to your income is that your income must not be more than 10% from that particular client, because the view is that if you're earning more than 10% from an income dependency, you lose your independence. We applied that criteria, knowing that we're also trying to open this to other firms. We also looked at the size of the firms but also looking at what the office needed. We said we should appoint a firm that has got the capacity to do the work. We said we should not be appointing firms of auditors with less than five partners, and three of those partners had to be based in Gauteng, so that if there are issues that the office needed, and or even the audit committee, there could actually be speedy resolution. So we said that as the criteria, just going back to the independence, we actually said if we're going to appoint anybody that is already doing work for the Auditor General's office, they must be prepared to give up totally all that work, because they can't do the audit and actually do other work. In fact, that actually was our first biggest challenge, because all the big firms, quite frankly, from an economics point of view, none of them was going to agree to give up the other work they do for the office. For them. Just to give you an indication, I think big firms will actually be getting in the double digits of millions from the Auditor General's office. We reckon that the fee for this audit is between 2 and 2.5 million, so they're not going to give that up. That's actually why we ended up with a challenge of a very few firms. We also said, even if we're going for the smaller firms, we needed to make sure that they'd actually pass the quality control from the independent regulatory body of auditors. We put that as a pre-qualifying. So if anybody had actually failed, that they were not eligible. I mean, the details of their turnover was really more relative to the questions of independence, and then the full details of the RPE status. So that we put as the pre-qualifying criteria. What we have done, Chairman and the committee, is that we've actually assessed high-level the firms on that basis and actually disqualified some and retained others. And we've ended up with six firms: Octagon Chartered Accountants, MDP Incorporated, F&O Incorporated, BKR Logistica, Logista, Moore Stephen, and CMA. Those are the firms that we're proposing that we look at. So that actually was, the 15th out criteria. We disqualified BDO because of the 10-year issue.
Yes, Mr. Machama, do you want to chip in?
Listening to the professor there, but what is a serious problem that he's saying to us? Some of their criteria is that the firm must be based in Gauteng. That's because it would be easy for them to phone them and get what they need. But with the technology now, I don't think it's a problem. If you need something from somebody who's in Natal or in Eastern Cape or so, if it's only the reason behind, or say now, we will confine ourselves to the people who are based in Gauteng. This is where the problem. If the criteria would work just to check besides the whereabouts of the firm, because that means now people must move to Gauteng so that they can get the business. If they are a company, that's why I'm having a problem.
I thought I understood him to be saying at least some of the partners.
Okay.
So it's not the entire firm that must necessarily be located.
But
your point still stands, do you actually confine yourself to a firm that's primarily based in Gauteng, or can a firm that's based in Cape Town or KZN, or anywhere in the country, be a preferred candidate, provided that at least they have some presence in Gauteng where your operations? I think that's the question. Is that the end of your question?
Chair,
Did you finish your question?
All right.
Chair, I think there's also the bigger question about why do we need to have a location criterion at all? Is it absolutely necessary to be within range, or can one not email accounts to people?
Well, I thought that the issue that is raised is that in the event that there is a need for person-to-person interaction beyond what technology can do, that it is a preferred thing to have some presence of senior partners where the within reach of the seat of the Auditor General's office itself. I'm not necessarily saying that I agree, but I'm just saying that's how I understand their argument to be, and it's up to them to confirm my understanding. I suppose then your question should rather be how critical is that? Because it's not just about your normal day-to-day activity. It's about situations where there may be a need for a person-to-person engagement. And to cut costs and the time it takes for people to get to meet. And maybe the issue also is how frequent would such situations be to necessitate proximity. All right? Have we properly captured your point before we... you also want to add to
that? Yeah, no, Chairperson, not on that, but I have a fundamental problem.
Mm.
In terms of the Audit Act, the oversight mechanism, and I'm reading from it, must annually appoint an independent external auditor to audit the accounts. And the oversight mechanism is us. Now, we obviously going to do it on the recommendation of the audit committee, because they've been working at it and things like that. But I think in the absence of any documentation before us, it makes it difficult to follow. I know Professor Moyo is talking about the firms and which firms and the criteria, but we have nothing before us because we, and especially you, Chairperson, will have to be answerable to the National Assembly at some stage because you would have appointed them. This committee would have appointed the external auditors. I don't know if it's an omission or something like that because it's always good to have some documents that we can look at. You've done an assessment.
I think you're raising a very critical point. I think in relation to the earlier part of the presentation, we were sort of reluctantly able to excuse them on the basis that there could have been a misunderstanding that by now we would have received the annual reports and have appraised ourselves with the content therein to enable us to engage more effectively, given the fact that that aspect of supposed to be contained there. Although we indicated that that is not adequate for our own purposes, the Auditor General has already set the precedent by putting a package for us last week already in preparation. So that made it easier for us to engage last week. We had assumed that the same approach would be adopted today, but it's even more so in relation to a matter where we have to exercise a statutory function. I mean, that's even more formal an exercise on our part. So it's critical that we are properly, presented with appropriate documentation to enable us to exercise due diligence. Ms. Debe, you want to follow up?
Thank you. Chairperson, I think really through you, let's agree that on issues like this, the recent one, not necessarily the first session, on this one, it's not going to be easy for us to agree or not agree. We don't have documents. There might be some other issues that must also apply our mind thoroughly on it. So I therefore propose that maybe, if possible, say something through you. We can go through the process or the input today. But before we commit ourselves with anything, we must accept the document and reconvene. For when, I don't know. But I don't think we'll be able to commit ourselves with any recommendation without accessing the document itself.
Well, once the committee has agreed as to a way forward, we will find time to do that. But let's first resolve the issue.
So, Chair, on the documents,
the committee actually met this morning to finally resolve some of the requirements. But there is actually a document. In fact, it's just a two-page document, which, in fact, I was thinking that the committee might actually, that might have been circulated. It's a two-page document, and it's not. And two, today we won't be asking the committee to appoint anybody because we don't have a firm that we're proposing to you. We don't. We're actually proposing the criteria, then, I mean, the process for it, so that you can then allow us to go away and actually do it in the way that we are proposing. But, I mean, there is a two-page document that I think, Chair, if you've got that, maybe we can actually adjourn for, it's not even a three-minute document. But I must also add that the document that you're going to see, we had some changes this morning, and I'll take you through the changes, through those changes.
Maybe we should at this juncture adjourn for tea for about 10 minutes. I understand the history. So that would also give us an opportunity to reflect on the many other issues that we have dealt with. All right.
Well, I've got
this is recommended by the government.
Ideally, we should be having documentation that can assist us in engaging. So we by implication, we're saying that we're going to call the audit committee again on another occasion, possibly at the time when the audit had been tabled and we can engage them even in respect to specifics that arise out of the audit itself, all right? As well as obviously the annual report would be out by then. But to say that ideally a much more elaborate presentation should be preceded by some kind of document on their side that kind of captures, summarizes the salient issues that they would want to convey. All right? And that's how we'll approach matters. By then, they would also be ready, I suppose, to also present to us proposals with regard to potential candidates for the next 10 years of an audit firm. All right. Do you want to just take us through the balance of your presentation, and then we conclude and then move on to the AG's office.
Thank you, Chair. So I'd actually spoken about the 10-year issue, what we have as the first filter. I just want to go back to the questions around the partners and their location. I know that it actually sounds like it disadvantages people that come from outside Gauteng, but there's the issue of the costs, because, I mean, part of what the office has to manage is the cost. Typically, when we have, let's say, a partner that comes from Cape Town, the moment he leaves his house, they're actually charging. And, I mean, part of what the office has to do, we actually have to manage those costs. There are also times that you actually have a lot of issues. And we can say emails, but there are times that we actually have to be talking and actually engaging with each other. So the proximity is also important. But ultimately, I want to leave it to you. That decision is yours. That actually was our recommendation. We actually felt it's actually wise to do that and actually have staff members that are based in Joburg. There are a whole lot of things. When you're actually finalizing the audit, when you actually come to the crunch, you don't want to be having people that on a Friday, when we actually want to finalize the financial statements, have to be leaving the office at 12 to go and catch a flight. Those are some of the practical issues. So we actually try to look at the practical considerations. But actually the number of partners also talks to the independence, because for a fee of 2.5 million, it's actually difficult not to be falling foul of the independence requirements if you don't have some more like five or so partners. Just for the committee's sake, we are also trying to help the small firms. We said, even if you want to do a joint audit, make sure that you, even if you're based in KZN, and you at least have three partners and managers that are based in Joburg, so that the office can actually have access to them. So even if your headquarters is in Cape Town, if you've got three partners that are resident in Joburg, it actually does work for us, for the reasons that I've said. So I've already talked about the partners, the contract work. In fact, the document, has, I'm sure the members have seen the document. The detailed IRPA reviews, it's important for this committee to make sure that you are appointing a firm that has itself passed any quality issues, because you have to be able to go to Parliament to say it's actually been, the financials have been audited by a reputable firm of auditors. I've already talked about their turnover in relation to the fees. The reason why we looked at that, it was in relation to the fees, because independence is important. And then the detailed information on the B status, like I said, that actually was an issue with the previous squad, to actually look at the B issues. So that was the first set of criteria that we've used. We have used those criteria to thin down the applications to the one where we ended up with Octagon, MDP, FNO, BKR, Most Even, and CMA. There's only one firm which we did not even go through what they'd written down being BDO, because we said in terms of our criteria, they've been with us more than 10 years. So now, having thinned it down, we've now asked for more information, and the information that we now require is how the firms are going to approach the audit. Is it acceptable to us? The detailed information on their qualifications and experience, because we're saying that we need to have a firm of auditors that have got, they've obviously got to be qualified, they've got to have the experience, both, and in fact, that's also the other change here, both in the private sector and in the public sector. We actually believe that if we appoint people that have the experience, so essentially, we are not exactly comfortable as the audit committee that the size of this audit, we can actually have a partner that's actually just passed this board exam to handle it. So we'll look at their, and if we have two partners that have got, let's say, the same kind of experience, we'll also look at their involvement in the public sector, because the public sector has got its own other nuances. So those are the things that we're looking at. As the committee, in terms of the experience, given the fact that we're also concerned about with the issues where certain people may be disqualified, we've actually said there is a point beyond which you're not going to be worrying about experience. Because, for example, if we actually said we are going to give more credit to somebody that has got 30 years experience compared to 7 years, we might actually be overriding, for example, unintentionally, the PE issue. So we've actually said we need to look at, I think, 5 years. Beyond 5 years, we're saying that we're not going to give you any credit for it to make sure that we are as inclusive as possible. We've also, particularly with the teams, we've also said we need to look at the racial and gender split with regard to the team that's dedicated to the Auditor General's office to cover the issues of BEE. And their confirmation that they're able to do this audit within the prescribed legislative framework. Since we've been in this committee, and in fact I think even long before we got in, the office has always delivered its financial statement on time. So we actually want to have a firm that can deliver the financial statement on time to actually have them approved within the requisite time. We also need to look at their indemnity cover, because each of the audit firms, from professional negligence, I mean, as the audit committee, and more importantly, you as the oversight mechanism, should they not discharge their duties properly, and there are some lawsuits attended to that, they must actually have a proper professional indemnity. It's actually a requirement anyway that when they do the audit, they actually have the. So those are the criteria that we have been applying. We then say to ourselves, we need to look at the weighting. Independence we've already looked at in the documents that we have independence as 10%, because independence was a pre-qualifying criterion anyway. We've actually taken that out, and I'll tell you now how we dealt with it. These are the discussions that we're having this morning. The audit approach, we left that as 30%. The quality, we took out the qualification of the firm, because it's difficult. We actually said we're going to look at the experience of the firm, how they've actually performed in terms of the IRPA review, both on the private sector and the public sector. So we're actually wanting a firm that has experience in those areas. But you can have a firm that has got experience. The risk that we sit with on audit failure is ultimately the team that actually gets put before us to do the audit. So we're also going to be evaluating specifically the team, and we've now split that not to 10 and 30, to 15, the firm and the team. And with the team, that's actually when we're going to be looking at the qualifications of the individual members, their experience both in the private and public sector of that team. And then we look at the price. We've actually said the price, because part of what we also have to manage is actually the cost of the audit. We have got a 20% weighting. And then on the BE compliance, we've actually split it. That's where the other 10% came in, to be 20%. We're going to look at the firm and the composition of the team. So that's actually, if the committee is comfortable, that's actually what we want to hash out and actually make our recommendations to you based on that. And if it's acceptable to the committee, we'll then go away and look at these firms on that criteria, and will then come with a proposed name to say we haven't done this, the proposal to the committee that will go with X.
Can I just check what kind of time frames are we looking at, or are you looking at?
Well, like I said, we're now sitting in a situation where we don't have
a firm.
Actually, the office doesn't have auditors, and we have to approve their audit plans at the November meeting. And if we're going to approve their plans at the November meeting, we should actually essentially really realistically have auditors appointed literally within, I think, going anything beyond the second week of September is too late.
And the procedure that should take us to September, can you just quickly outline what are the steps that should occur that should lead to September, the final adoption of a new firm?
Sorry, let me just, we've said in this document that we need to do it by 30th September. So 30th September is that by 30th September, SCOAC should actually have approved. But for us to be able to take it to SCOAC with all the documents, if we give ourselves up to about 2 weeks, we're actually sitting not much later than the middle of September. And the process is that we've already called for proposals on the criteria that we laid out. We've not started the process. We know the 6 or 8 names that we are going through the first filter. And if you're broadly comfortable with this criteria, we're then going to go away and actually now go through the details.
How did we arrive at these names? Were they nominated? Did you go out and identify them? Did they tender or
they
make
tendered.
Themselves available?
They tendered.
Oh, they tendered.
It was right. Actually a public tender. And it was based on the criteria that I outlined up front. That's why I was saying that we felt strongly that the committee needs, because it's an appointment ultimately, because we actually appoint, we slim them down on those criteria.
Is the fact that we don't have an audit at the moment not affecting the committee deleteriously?
No, it's actually not through you, Chair. It's not, because what will typically happen from October, they start doing their planning generally for the next financial year. But the only issue that makes us slightly uncomfortable, some firms actually do what they call continuous audit. So the sooner we appoint them, in fact, going into the future, I think it is ideal that by about the 1st of April, as a committee, we are ready to appoint auditors. Because they can want, in fact, part of our problem this year was that we had actually elections in April, and we had actually wanted to do this thing by April.
No, we were alerted early on that this is an urgent matter. Mr. Stitt.
Thank you, Chair. A concern that I have in terms of this process is the norm in all tendering is to separate your bid evaluation exercise from your bid adjudication. They should ideally be done by different groups of people. If the audit committee is going to adopt this matrix and perform the bid evaluation, I don't think it would be appropriate for them to then also do the adjudication.
Isn't the adjudication done by us?
That is exactly the point that I'm making.
All right.
And if the adjudication is done by us, then we need to actually see the evaluation results which they have performed on all 6 of these candidate firms, so that we can then meet at SCOAG in terms of the PAA and actually do the adjudication of that tender. But I really believe that the
the whole process needs to be separated out.
Can I just say that the last time this exercise was done would have been 10 years ago. Mm. So probably some institutional memory may have been lost about how it was done then and what are the lessons that were learned from that previous process. So that's why the first question I asked was, what are the steps that must take us to the end of September so that we're very clear as to the road getting us to September? You want to respond immediately? Is it a follow-up on Mr. Steele's question? Okay,
yeah.
Let's start here.
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow up. I don't think it's our responsibility to adjudicate. It's our responsibility to appoint. But it goes back to the first two lines in this document. The previous COAC could have given the audit committee, as it's stated here, the mandate to oversee the process and make recommendations. Now, this is work in progress, right? We've got to look at what the previous COAG resolution was. And maybe it said, we are mandating the audit committee to invite tenders, to develop criteria, to make recommendations. And if that decision was taken, I don't think it's fair for us to go and reverse that kind of decision. But we've got to know, this is why when we have completed this exercise, the complete set of documents should include at least a resolution about the 10 years and a resolution which has given the audit committee the mandate to oversee the process. I mean, it might be a mandate that was given. We don't know. We've come in new. But like I say, this is work in progress. For us to go and adjudicate and all that, you know, I don't know. Sure.
Starting point is, the last time this process was done was not 10 years. The last time this process was done was last year. Because last year, we actually went and chose a firm of auditors, and we ended up choosing BDO because a decision had already been taken that we must actually go out on tender.
All right.
This audit committee is well aware that the appointment of the auditors is a function of SCOAG. We agreed with the previous SCOAG on how it ought to be done. And what we agreed with SCOAG was that, firstly, you say the norm in terms of tendering. Actually, the norm in terms of appointing auditors is, in fact, you'll actually find that in the New Companies Act, the appointment of auditors is now actually just the preserve of the audit committee, and the annual general meeting approves that. The annual general meeting might actually vote against the proposal. Then the audit committee must actually go back and actually come with another name. So we actually spent a lot of time in some of our workshops talking about, in a company with the audit committee, with the shareholder, and we actually said, you actually play almost the role of the shareholder, and you want to get involved in the adjudication, and the answer with the previous co-work was that, no, but if you want to do it, it's your prerogative. In fact, if you want to run the whole process, it is actually a prerogative because you have to appoint. And so we actually, with the way that we've taken it, that's why it's important for us to be clear on the criteria, because if you sign off on these criteria, we will go out and judiciously apply these criteria and come back to you, Chairman, and say, let's go out. You gave us those criteria. Having applied the criteria, our recommendation is X. Should you actually want to go and interrogate the adjudication, but I also must stress that because of the independence issues, the office cannot be part of it. That's why the process is run entirely by, we use the secretarial to help us. I mean, even in opening those things, when we came down to these last six It actually was done under my supervision, somebody from the thing. So we're happy with ultimately your decision. You can tell us how you want to do it, but this is what we agreed with the previous work.
Look, I'll entertain the committee's response to that question. But for a moment, I lost you when you said that actually an appointment was made last year.
Yes.
And I thought, what is this exercise about if, in fact, an appointment is already made?
No, for the year before. For the year to 31st March 2009.
Are you referring to the formal exercise of appointment prescribed in the law?
Yes, we actually went... We actually went through... Because you said that the last time this exercise was done was 10 years ago. We went through...
No, that's not the kind of exercise I'm talking about. I'm talking about the 10-year exercise where you review the whole long-term, in quote, identification of a step as distinct to the... formalistic renewal of contract.
No, we actually went through a thorough process because if we'd gotten the candidates that we wanted, BDO were not going to be the auditors in 2009. So
yeah.
We actually went through exactly the same process.
But if you've done that, why are we doing this?
No, because, well, sir, can I just say, we're doing this because if the previous squad, they'd instructed us to go and appoint a new firm and went through exactly this process, and the firm that we looked at, when we went through these criteria, they did not qualify. So we went to squad and actually said we've gone through the process. Our recommendation for 2009 is that we retain BDO. So we went through the full thing. If let's say one of these firms had qualified, BDO will not have the...
So what you're saying is that after having gone through the exercise, you found that you are not able to make a new appointment.
Yes.
That's in short what you're
yeah.
saying. All right. You want to come in? And then I'll...
Yes, Chair. Perhaps to give some context to that, at the time, SCOAG was chaired by now Minister Barbara Hogan. There was a major concern. BDO Spencer Stewart failed dismally on broad-based black economic empowerment. And as a result of that, SCOAG charged us, notwithstanding that they'd only served 9 years, they said they were bitterly disappointed by that. Could we please go out and try and source a firm that was black empowered? We put out tenders, or we charged the governance department within the AG's office to put out tenders, and the quality of tenders that came in was such that the firms that were tendering, I mean, there was a two-partner firm from Cape Town that tendered to do an audit in Pretoria, just to give you an example. There was a dismal level of tenders received. BDO was the only firm that came close to meeting the criteria. They failed on the black empowerment.
On the question. Obviously, BE, that's one aspect.
Yeah. And therefore, our recommendation to SCOAG was we would like to reappoint BDO for one last year, and then we're going to set processes in motion to make sure that we can find somebody to tender that meets criteria in the following year.
In short, all you did was to defer
yes.
this exercise for now. All right. Let me start with who was first. So that's Mr. Singh.
The Chairperson, thank you. Before I ask my question, I would just like to know, you see, the reason we're asking these questions because we, as members sitting on SCOAG, want to protect the integrity of the Office of the Auditor General. Because we clamp down on everybody. The two of us serve on SCOPA. And we call, not we, I'm saying using a royal, we use all kinds of words against directors general and things like that. And we don't want them to turn around and point a finger at our processes. For example, the DAG told us that one of his auditors walked in into an office and said, where's the appointment letter of the Premier? Right? I mean, it's a trivial thing. And then the person, you know, I mean, those are the kind of questions that auditors ask. So we're trying to put ourselves in that shoe to be above reproach for your sake. Not for our sake, but for the sake of the AG's integrity and the office. When was the decision or resolution taken by SCOAC that a firm should not be appointed for 10 consecutive years? Or should that should lapse after this? When was that resolution taken? Was it 10 years ago? Or was it only last year? And then I'll follow up, Chairperson.
Because taken chair.
Somebody auditor could come to Parliament and ask where is the copy of the resolution that elected me as the chairperson of this committee.
Okay.
And I hope that the committee secretary will be able to produce it.
But I have a follow-up.
wait, be patient. You'll only answer questions once we finish.
Yes. Chairperson, I'll have a follow-up after the answer to that question.
Yes.
But can we get an answer? When
you want this answer first?
When did SCOAC resolve that no firm should be appointed for more than 10 consecutive years?
All right, you want to answer that specifically?
I can't give you the exact date, but Adil, I think it's about 2 years ago.
Yes,
I also mentioned what happened in the January workshop. Once again, we shared with the
January this year or last year?
January this year, there was inner engagement with the outgoing SCOAC, indicating we're facing a situation where we're going to have to replace SCOAC. And it was once again agreed there that there is a need to replace the external auditor urgent because of the 10-year rule. But that was a workshop, so it's not. I'm not sure if there's formal minutes taken there.
Chairperson, can I then follow up?
Just before you proceed. Because of the 10-year criteria, to prove that in fact it was a criteria and not a rule, you broke it because you decided to renew at the end of 9 years. And had you not been in a situation where you could not find a suitable substitute, you would, in fact, have renewed at the end of 9 and not at the end of 10 years. Now, if it was a rule, you would have broken the rule. No.
The rule says we can go up to 10 years. That's the maximum. The criteria says we can go, no firm can go beyond 10 years. You could terminate any time. So,
all right.
Look, it's a yearly appointment.
Look, I don't really want us to go back to that whole issue.
Chairperson,
you wanted to make a follow-up on this?
That decision was taken last year. My point is, as much as we may not like BDO, BDO should not be disqualified from putting in a tender. Legally, I'm not a lawyer, right? I'm a bus driver. Legally, they should not be disqualified, in my view, my humble opinion, from putting in a tender. If they fail on criteria, that's another matter. Because when they first got this thing, there was no 10-year rule. The 10-year rule came last year, and they only there for 1 year from the time the rule was put. We can now resolve, in terms of our criteria, the resolution of this committee, that no firm should have been appointed for more than 10 years from now onwards. But I don't think BDO can be excluded from putting their tender in. And then if the committee decides, well, the BE that you failed, then you failed them on that, not on any 10-year thing. I think we're on slippery ground. You, the lawyer.
Even if we do say so, as long as it's not written in the law, it will still not be binding on a future SCOAC anyway. But I do not want to go into that whole exercise. So maybe I'll write a legal opinion on this issue, just to make it easier. But somebody else, Adele, you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to mention the fact that in 2007, what happened is specifically the SCOAC advised us as the office that they were concerned about the length of time of BDO. And that's where it originally started. So just to mention, it was also the initiative from the committee asking, you know, is it appropriate for this length of time for the auditors to
to serve, and that's where we did our research as well and indicated the, you know, that it's not appropriate for them to more than 10 years.
Sure.
I do understand the sentiment that when BDO were appointed, this rule or this criteria was not there. But there is, just like they can turn around and say the BE criterion was not there. This is an annual appointment, and we can actually put whatever criteria that we want, as long as it's actually fair to everybody. And by the way, even this thing was discussed with BDO themselves. I'm not even talking now, when we reappointed them to do the 2008-2009 audit, we did tell them that. In fact, BDO, by the way, they did not fail the previous time only because of BEE or the 10-year rule, whatever. They actually failed. Vince, correct me. They failed on the income levels. Their fees were less than 20 million, and the fees for the audit office was just over 2 million. They failed. So we went to SCOAG and said, in terms of the rules or the criteria that we've agreed with you, nobody meets that. So we're not going to appoint in terms of the tender. We now feel that let's extend the incumbent. So I don't, I mean, and again, I will keep on going back to saying, ultimately, the criteria that we use is SCOAG's criteria. This is our recommendation. We're comfortable that for independence sake, even if they were never appointed on that understanding, it's actually a normal thing anyway to rotate auditors, and we can actually put, it's a normal thing even in companies, and it's, I think it's good governance also.
Usually when you advertise a job, you set out up front the requirements for the job, and some of the requirements relate to the minimum qualifications. I do not believe that you fall foul of the law if you make an exception. You get an excellent candidate who may not have a university degree, but his level of experience and knowledge and skill is such that they would perfectly be able to discharge the duties of that office. Do you then say, because he's had a university degree, you're not going to appoint? See, that's where a rule and criteria part ways. If it's a rule, if it's in the law that thou shalt not appoint a person who does not have a university degree to this position, if you do appoint that person, you have broken the law. And somebody will point to a section in an act and say, in terms of section 212, subparagraph A, of Act number so and so, you have not followed this rule that says why. But if it's a criterion and you have departed, you've relaxed it because you found a perfect candidate, even though he didn't quite meet all the criteria you've set, that person can take you to court and say, but why did you appoint somebody who does not meet criterion? Why? You know, a rival competitor, for example, you know. Because you'd be able to show that you made a reasonable decision based on rational grounds, you know. You didn't make a rash decision because you're applying nepotism or some kind of bias, all right? That's where the distinction between a criterion and a rule comes in. That's why I'm saying at some point I may have to write a legal opinion just to show people, you know, where the distinction happens. And my understanding is that, in fact, this was the situation last year. The criterion was that you should appoint, ideally, for a maximum period of 10 years. Somebody at you know, at some point at age 9, the committee felt, you know, hang on, there's a problem with this firm. It's done very little to improve its BE rating. We think we can't wait for the 10 years to renew it. So let's consider a new firm. Unfortunately, in the process of trying to do that, you couldn't actually find an ideal substitute. So you decided, no, let's keep them for another year. Let's, in any case, go for the full 10 years. But let's make sure not beyond the 10 years. So we are sitting now in a situation. 10 years has lapsed. The firm has finished. And we are now reopening the process up. And in so doing, we are hoping that we'll get a different firm to the firm that we are actually involved in. Yes, I don't think you can, strictly speaking, open up a tender process and say you are not allowed and to tender unless there is a law that prohibits. You can tell them that in terms of our criteria, just to give you an example of a body that I served in, which incidentally is made out of judges, including the Chief Justice himself, the Judicial Services Commission. One of its unwritten rules, which is a practice or policy, if you like, is that once we appoint you as a judge in the Cape Town High Court, that's what we appointed you for life. If you come back and say the following year after we have appointed, no, actually my wife is working in Johannesburg and my children are there, so can you please move me to Johannesburg? We tell you, you know very well what our practice is. We don't appoint people just to become judges. We appoint people to a specific court. And we've actually turned down a whole lot of such applications. But they come back every year and try that. They know that our policy is that we won't move them. All right? But there may be circumstances where we find we must depart from that rule. All right? Or practice. There is nothing in the law that says we may not allow such an or entertain such an application. And there's nothing in the law that says we should allow such an. It's a matter of discretion. But we make those criteria known to the profession so that even before they apply to us, they already know what our attitude is. And that's why this document becomes critical to be known upfront to potential candidates for appointment so that they know that it is the attitude of SCOEC, which is shared by this committee that advises SCOEC on appointment, that our attitude is to, for the sake of continuity, to keep firms up to a maximum period of tenure so that they can also plan properly. That we would reluctantly renew an appointment before the lapse of that period. But they would also have to understand that that is not a binding rule. In fact, we cannot write rules for ourselves. I serve in the Rules Committee, and in this Parliament I chair review of rules, so I know that no portfolio committee or standing committee can write rules for itself. Only the House can amend the rule book of Parliament. And as long as something is not in the rule book, is not in an act of Parliament, is not in the Constitution, is not a rule. But nothing stops Parliament or the Rules Committee, stops this committee from adopting or approaching its work in a particular way and adopt certain conventions, certain cultures, certain practices, certain norms, and actually follow them. So that there's certainty. And that's normal everywhere. But I think let's conclude it on the basis that it seems to me, and I'm going back to Mr. Singh's point, that the previous SCOEC had opportunity to go through this criteria, applied its mind, and was satisfied that that is a fair set of criteria. In fact, that is a question. May sound as a comment, but that's a question. Such that the criteria was then applied already in an exercise that already happened of identifying potential candidates for appointment. That then also informed a shortlisting, which has in fact happened. And that shortlisting comprises of the list of firms that are mentioned there under point, is it point three? And that therefore we are at a stage as this committee where unless there is something contained here, if seriously amiss, I mean, I don't think that we are absolutely bound. So if there's something that's seriously amiss, then we can raise it. But other than that, for the sake of continuity, we would accept that as a set of criteria that have in fact already been used, that we are catching the process at a point as the new parliament, in the middle of that process, at a point where we have to decide whether we mandate the audit committee to proceed from where they are with that process and then come back to us. I think that's the question we need to make a decision on. All right? First of all, have I correctly characterized where we are insofar as the process? Because we were not here before 22 April. Is that a correct reflection of where we are?
It's a correct reflection. I just want to add on to what Adil said, because the previous committee became uncomfortable. I think it was year 7 or year 8 about the length of time any audit firm. So even at 8 years, so in fact even that process we went through last year, it was before the 10 years, the previous committee had actually said that they were very uncomfortable. I, together, assisted by Adil, did that exercise to look at the JSC, because at that time they were already uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And they had actually wanted us to do that process. We were late. Then we went through the process fully last year. And that's really, and we shared the first bit with our own workshop as the audit committee, I think in January. Then we took it to Adil, was it January or February, one of the meeting with the previous SCOAC, January 2009, where we went through the first set of criteria that
just use your mic.
I said no, it was the first set of criteria on the first page. If you look at this first set of 5 bullets, which we used for the second criteria, those were agreed upon with the previous guide. So we used that to do the second criteria.
So that basically just confirms the summary I tried to put forward. All right. Can I just reconfirm? Earlier I summarized the rule or the convention that has been adopted as follows, that the recommendation is that ideally a firm may not serve for longer than 10 years, all right, but at least a minimum period of 5 years. Would that be more or less the understanding or not? Not at all. You okay? Clarify.
Chair, I have a major problem with that. We have a situation, a very common situation in the accountancy profession, and that is that firms merge. And if you have a merger between two firms, one of which does work on behalf of the Auditor General and one that doesn't, so you've got firm A and firm B. A does work for the AG. B does the audit of the AG. If those two firms merge, that merged firm is no longer independent, and there's no way that we would reappoint them without coming back and getting SCOAC's permission.
But that issue wouldn't be a problem at all, based on what I've just said. Because it's not a rule.
You said that for a minimum of
5 years. No, let me explain myself. It wouldn't be a problem for the simple one reason. that what I've just said is not a rule. It's just a norm.
If
there are new circumstances that require to depart from the earlier undertaking,
as long as
precisely.
As long as you say caperis paribus, all other things being equal, then
that is implied. That is implied. So essentially all we're saying is that we're setting some kind of guide for people so that they have a sense of more or less how we're working. We're not tying ourselves into a rule. And the example you've just given reaffirms the significance of that distinction.
Chair, I'll word it, slightly differently.
All right.
I think already the Act has already defined the 1 year minimum. Okay, so the minimum is already there. There is, however, the practicality in terms of you exercising your oversight that you need a firm that you know has actually, what do they say, new brooms sweep very well, but the old brooms know all the
corners. That's delved into the situation.
So we actually think from a practical point of view, why we don't necessarily want to articulate it, where the 10 years, we can articulate it in our criteria. The 5 year becomes an internal working thing within us, so that you know that we're not going to be coming to you every year. Because if we've got concerns, we actually don't...
So all you're saying is that there's no need to mention a minimum.
No, as long as we understand with yourselves that once you appoint whoever on this basis...
I don't have any problem. I mean, to me, I just thought it would be good to bring that understanding in the formulation, but fine.
Yes, no, I'm happy to bring it in the formulation. I'm just saying that it's our internal thing, not the one that we...
Yeah. Not even...
But I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, So who came first? Was it Mr. Singh? Dr. Judge, yeah?
Thank you, Chairperson. What I'm hearing is this issue about an overarching criterion of good governance. Now, we've got a set of criteria that set our functionality, etc. Okay? It doesn't talk about the 10 years. That 10 years was it's a good governance issue. To my mind, and I'm not a lawyer, it isn't a good thing to keep an auditor for too long, and it's a good thing to change it. So therefore, I do think that we must take that into consideration. I do think that after 10 years, you've been here probably too long. My view, it should be even less. But anyway, every single year...
And maybe you want to make that specific proposal.
Okay.
That specific proposal.
Maybe,
but that's fine.
But the point that I'm making is every single year it is necessary for us to look at everybody that's doing stuff for in this instance and say, right, is it okay or is it not okay? If it's not okay, off you go, even if you've only been around for 1 year. So I don't think we should be setting minimums, but I think a maximum isn't a bad thing. However, I suppose if you got to the end of 10 years and there was some kind of really pressing reason why you would want to have them around, maybe you were, I don't know, adjusting or restructuring or whatever, I don't know, maybe you'd want to, but that's probably not a good idea. So really, I do think that...
But you're not proposing an invitation to tender every year. You're simply saying every year we must do a thorough evaluation.
I'm saying that, yes. I'm saying that every year... We should look, I think perhaps the committee needs to look at the incumbent and say, right, are you delivering the goodies? If the conclusion is no, then I think a process needs to happen, yes. And so if you're happy with them and here you go, and maybe you haven't, then here you get to 10 years. I think at that point you should be saying, we need to throw the whole door open.
I can upfront confirm that is the correct interpretation of the law. To do anything less would actually be meaning that we are failing in the discharge of our statutory obligation. Yes, Mr.
Chairperson, thank you. You know, the 10-year thing came about directly because of BDO. No other reason at that time. It's a good governance practice. But from what we hear, because BDO was not the right firm, we said, let's give them one more year. Why must we mention 10 years or 5 years anyway? Why don't we follow?
I understood.
We must follow the law. The law says anyway.
No, wait, Mr. Singh. I think it was explained at the beginning how it came about. All right? It was not purely because of video. All right? It is because somewhere along the way, an issue arose in SCOAT as to what is good practice in the profession. Is it good practice that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things are allowed to happen? Now, one of those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things was the period, the unbroken period of service that you can allow one firm to provide in the form of an audit service to any office. And a point was then raised to say, professionally, generally speaking, it is bad practice to appoint people forever because of the motivation that the chairperson alluded to. That it's not even a question whether these people become too cozy with the people they're auditing, but the perception may develop that the longer you stay with people, you become too cozy with them. That's why we get re-elected every 5 years. We might become too comfortable in our, you know. So that is the thinking. Whether BDO had in fact stayed so long and people are beginning to ask is besides the issue. The issue was, what is good practice? All right? Because if somebody had motivated well that in fact it's good practice to appoint people as long as possible, then the issue of BDO and the fact that they've served for 10 years wouldn't have arisen as an issue. All right? So there's an underlying issue of principle. All right? And the significance relates back to the issue of independence. All right? So that is the context in which it arose, and I think that's the context in which we should engage it. All right? Now, your point earlier, that we can't tell BDO not to bid even after they've done 10 years is in fact correct. Because you can't prevent somebody unless there is a law that says they may not. But you can put up your criteria that you use in evaluating upfront so that people know. Okay? So that BDO does not have to waste its resources bidding when they know that factor is going to weigh heavily against us.
They just submitted tender.
Excellent.
They responded.
Excellent. We'll look at it, even
but
if they've done tenure.
No,
we don't ignore it. We take it.
No. Then, because I must say, some of these things I just really get confused. Because even how we disqualified other people, we said, your fee income is below the criteria. Once we actually saw that, we stopped looking at that. Mm. But I mean, if this committee is actually, because at the end of the day, we need to know what that criteria means. Because if it's a criteria that is 10 years, and we actually see that we've been there 10 years, we're not wasting our time. Just like if we see that you don't meet the BEA requirement, we're not going to waste our time and actually look at it. So that's why earlier on, for me...
Let's not belabor these things. Let me try and explain for the last time, but let's not really hammer on the same thing. The fact that you were able to appoint BDO last year, even though they did not meet the BEA criteria, just shows that a criteria in itself is not a be it all, it's not a rule. Mm. You see, if it was a rule, you wouldn't have appointed DDO.
No, but I think, Chair, that's not the issue. All I'm saying, I'm hearing you say that we must still evaluate BDO. I'm saying that the offense on the criteria, whether it's a rule or not.
Because I think we're losing each other. We really are losing.
Well, I'm, because I'm saying I'm confused because we have 14.
Can I just try and make it easier for you? You appointed BDO last year. BDO did not meet one of your important criteria, and that was the BEE criteria.
Yes.
All right. There were certain criteria which BDO did not meet.
Yes.
But you nevertheless renewed their contract. I'm saying to you now, if those criteria were actually rules, you wouldn't have been able to renew BDO. The very reason why you were still able to renew their contract, even though they did not meet those criteria, is precisely because they were criteria.
Well,
so all we are saying, I gave you an example of the JSC. I said judges still apply to be moved from one court to the other every year, and they repeat the application. And they get shortlisted. And they come, we interview them, and we tell them, you are aware of our criteria that says we don't allow transfers. Why do you still apply? And they try and twist our arm as much as they can. But in the end, we simply don't transfer them. All right? We can't stop them from trying their luck every year. All right? So I'm just saying that these are criteria that must inform the process of selection, right? But in the end, you apply your mind informed by these criteria, which are reasonable. Because remember, if any of your criteria is unreasonable, then it becomes unlawful. This is a reasonable criteria, but it's not a rule, it's not a law. So you apply it in evaluating.
I've read that, Chief, because there's a practical issue here that we need to deal with. The question was, should we consider BDO, and we're saying that BDO put in a bid, and in terms of the criteria, that one criteria would disqualify them. So we didn't even look any further. But what I'm hearing this committee, some of the members, saying BDO must be in. That's the same.
Chairperson, I think, sorry, on a point of order here. You see, Chair of Audit Committee, you disqualified BDO, you said earlier, on the basis of the 10 years.
Yes.
And we are saying there's nothing here that says anything about 10 years. There might be other criteria on which BDO can be disqualified, and then disqualified. We're not saying put them in, but look for some other criteria other than the 10 years. You spoke about the BEE. They're not BEE compliant.
No, we've not. You see, can I? Chair, I'm saying that what confuses me. Like, when you say there is not that criteria here,
yeah.
Because I think you're talking to the Act.
Yeah. Or yes.
No, that's actually my point, that this was actually drafted after we spent time with SCOAC, and it was one of the criteria here, and the only firm in this country that was affected by that criterion was BDO. So we spoke to BDO. It was only one firm that was affected by that criterion. It was only BDO. So that criterion, we could actually have put it here because it was one of the criterion that was here. So we can actually write it.
Why is it not here?
No, well, because we've actually gone through with SCOAC and actually discussed it.
Okay, just a minute before I come to you. Your colleague wanted to say something.
I just wanted to explain that was actually the first criterion that we applied.
Yeah.
And it only affected the BDO firm because, they served for the past 10 years.
Where is the criteria?
No, this document was not drafted. This document was a working document for us. If we set out the process, the first criterion that we applied was to say, and that was the decision made by the previous guy. Have you served for nearly 10 years or 10 years, yes or no? If it is yes, then unfortunately, you won't be able to serve again.
Can I just wait. I'm not allowing you to read anything. I'm not allowing you to read anything. You see, this thing is so simple, so straightforward, uncomplicated. And frankly, it's something that's applied in many other processes. It's not the first time I encounter a situation like this. I honestly feel that we have wasted a good probably an hour or so on a matter that we shouldn't have wasted so much time on. So we really have to find a different way of managing this, because really it's completely unnecessary. But let me first hear the other people who wanted to say something. Honorable Zerbe.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think we have wasted a lot of time on this matter. And earlier on, your summary captured everything. The problem is that we were able to reopen it again. Because if you can remember and recapture that summary, it includes the 10-year, the 1-year, because the 1-year is covered by the Act itself. We cannot even talk about it. The 10-year is a practice. And all of us here, in principle, we agree. So I don't see why we
have
where
the problem is.
If you can just recapture what you have summarized earlier on, that summary was more than enough, because we have captured everything in that summary.
Look, can I... Yes? Well... Sorry, the Deputy Auditor General.
Thank you, Chair. I understand the summary that the Chair has made with regards to this matter, but I still understand the dilemma that the Chair of the Committee has, who oversees this process. And that dilemma is around the qualifying criteria that was set at the level of gatekeeping for any of those firms that responded to the tender. What was being suggested by Mr. Singh, or whoever made the suggestion earlier, was that we were only looking at the one criteria, which is the 10-year criteria, to try and reintroduce, for example, BDO, because we were saying that they were disqualified unfairly because the 10-year criteria was never an issue to be considered. I think the question that the Chair of the Committee is having is thinking about other firms that may have been disqualified on other criteria. What is their status going forward? I think that's the dilemma that needs to be sorted out. So that when they go forward, they know that either these ones that they've eliminated still stand, or these ones together with any other that may be unfairly disqualified also come back into the picture. Because I think the focus, which probably causes the confusion, is that it was predominantly around the 10-year rule. Mm-hmm. But there are other firms that genuinely submitted tenders, but on the issue of the finance percentage of the audit fee may be disqualified immediately. What happens to those ones? Because that also was a criteria that was considered as a gatekeeping criteria. That, to me, is probably still one thing to share in your summary that you can help clear, so that the way forward is clear even for the audit committee.
Can I just attempt to outline this thing in a sequential way? We have the constitution that outlines the broad framework. Under the constitution, we have the Act, the Audit Act, that has specific rules that govern this institutional arrangements and this process. Below that, we have structures that have been established, be it by the Act or the Constitution, including ourselves as a committee, that have been given specific responsibilities, statutory and constitutional. One of these institutions is the Audit Committee, which is established under the Act. The Audit Committee's role is to do all the assessment, do all the work that's necessary, and advise this committee to enable it to make a correct appointment. That is specifically in relation to the appointment of independent external auditor. All right? Now, obviously, both the Audit Committee and SCOWAC, in the course of discharging their statutory and constitutional mandates, develop practices, develop procedures, develop processes which are not necessarily spelled out in the law itself on the conduct of their business. All right? That is entirely their prerogative. All right? In this instance, a decision was taken that it is necessary that a set of criteria is outlined up front for any potential appointees or candidates for appointment. That would inform on an objective basis, all right, the decision on who to appoint. Now, those criteria are what is contained here. They may not be all inclusive. To the extent that they are not inclusive of everything that should be in here, this exercise should rectify that. All right? One of the criteria which is not expressly in here, which I understand is not in here because the print is too small, the chapter is partially cited, is that because it is good audit practice not to allow the same firm to serve for too long, there is a need to have a cut-off point as a criteria, right? The suggested reasonable period is 10 years. Mr. Singh has even asked the question, is 10 years not too long? We can debate that. We may agree that indeed he's correct, or we may say, no, we think for now, let's stick with the 10 years. It's the most reasonable, it's the ideal under the circumstances. Especially because we already have a precedent, and say, let's stick to the precedent. But of course, we can change that. We can say now that we're not going to appoint for longer than 5 years. There is no binding rule. But equally, somebody mentioned an important point, and that is the fact that by law, every year we must make an appointment. But our practice will be that we're not going to make a fresh appointment every year unless circumstances are compelling for us to deviate from that and stick to not renewing at the end of a year. Right. Now, this is a set of criteria. They are not law. And this criteria must be made known to potential candidates so that they know what they're dealing with, so that they prepare themselves, so that they evaluate themselves to see, is it worth us making the effort? For example, if experience, for example, is one of the criteria, then a firm knows that we consist of newly qualified auditors here. What is the point of wasting our time and resources to bid when we know our chances of being appointed are too slim? All right? But legally, nothing stops them from bidding. They bid. You look at them, you say, no, they're a new firm. There's no point in us wasting our time on them. Out. All right? So what we're saying is that when you then evaluate candidates, you then apply this criteria, all right? You yourself have put weights to each criteria. You've said B is 10%, this is 20%. You may find that, as has happened with BDO, that they were lacking on a number of other criteria, including BEE, all right? But you nevertheless appointed them because BE was not the only criterion there. And when you compared them with the other firms, you found that on the balance, if you like, they were the better of the two evils, if you like. Because in life, you don't always get a perfect situation. Sometimes you have to make a choice between not so ideal options. But the criteria are there to assist you and to guide you. Not only you, but to assist and guide potential candidates so that they know what is expected of them. So they can do proper preparation. They can evaluate themselves whether
that an ideal candidate for a position. Now, how you then apply those criteria, you're sitting in a meeting, you're looking at the applications or tenders, and you're evaluating them on the basis of the criteria, and you decide on the basis of your evaluation that, no, this firm we're not going to even shortlist. It's out of the question. You see? We will only remain with this firm, but there's still going to be a further detailed evaluation of those firms. And if in the end, you know, you end up with a process of elimination until you get the very best of the choices that you have. And that's where the appointment takes place. It's as simple as that, you see. This chicken and egg thing, I think, is not even an issue, you see, as to which of the two or five criteria must come first. It's not really the issue. The issue is that you have a set of criteria, each of which is a disqualifying factor. But because you have to balance out a whole lot of considerations, all right, you end up. Because if this year, for example, we end up with a situation where all the other firms are just hopelessly far below the standard that BDO is able to set, or hopelessly overpriced, are you just going to appoint because you have restricted yourself in terms of tenure? You won't. You see? You'll weigh the circumstances, compare things, and say, under the circumstances, we think that's actually what happened last year. You looked at BDO, and you said, we're dismissing BDO. You looked around, you couldn't find something better. You ended up with BDO even when you had decided you were not going to proceed with them. So that's basically how it works. I don't think there is a need to complicate it, to make a whole big, because remember, the entry point is the bidding process. Somebody must actually come forward and make themselves available. But they must make themselves available having had the benefit of preview of your criteria. That's the fairest way to do it. And it's their prerogative to decide how they interpret your criteria and whether they think, even though a criterion disqualifies them, whether they should apply or not. It's not your fault. If I come forward and apply when I know that there are some criteria that are excluding me, I know that when you start evaluating me, you're going to disqualify. And if the criteria are fair and reasonable, nobody will challenge you successfully in court. On what basis? And it's as simple as that. I wish I could simplify it further than that. I simply don't have the ability. All right. Now,
Chair. Yes. So I think now we are saying the audit committee must continue the process.
Precisely. We're saying the audit committee will endorse your criteria, which you already applied, to actually do the evaluation up to this point. We give you the go-ahead to proceed on the same footing that you, as far as we're concerned, we don't see any apparent flaw in what you've done thus far. And we expect you, at the end of that process, to come to us and report that you have done your job and this is what you have finally arrived at, and that's what you're putting forward for recommendation to this committee. All right. I think that concludes our deliberations on this issue. Particularly, we don't seem to have the time to deal with anything else because it's 5 past 1. But I'll allow Mr.
Thank you, Chair.
To have the last part.
No problems at all in terms of what you're saying. I'm just wondering how we're going to capture in what you have said, which is essentially a mandate now to the audit committee to continue the fact that there are, in fact, three other matters that we are mandating the AEC to look at. Those would include issues such as the proportion of the billing, issues such as the experience of the partners. Do we need to make those explicit, written down as part of a resolution mandating the AEC, or can we take it that following your summary and the discussion that those points are now clearly understood and that they will be applied as part of this?
Now, any of the criteria that have not been mentioned can still be added or amplified. I don't see this thing being something static. Remember, it's not a law. Let me just also indicate that because it's us who make the appointment, ultimately we must be satisfied that we're making a correct appointment. So even these criteria are simply a guide. We're not binding law or anything. It's a guide for both parties, for both the audit committee and for the candidates. So if there is any further addition, I think the document should still be made public or communicated to those people who are still going to be subjected to this evaluation process, so they know that in terms of our understanding or our view, those things should be taken into account as well. Yes, sir.
Thanks.
The question of the experience is actually in the document in terms of the weighting. The only thing that's slightly different that maybe, and you're suggesting is good, we're going to send a fresh document because this was the working document this morning. We actually amended, like I said, the weighting and actually changed some weighting on the even on the definition of the experience. But I mean, all that is actually captured on...
You can even quote us. You can say, according to the decision of the of SCOEC, this is the final set of criteria that we are expected to apply as the audit committee in evaluating candidates. So that if anybody challenges you, you can send them over to us.
We'll send you the new document.
Any audit firm that is unhappy with your criteria and wants to challenge them, they're at liberty to confront this committee. All right. So it's no longer entirely in your hands. And that leaves you. If you've made enemies through this criteria, just pass on the enmity over to us. All right.
Chairperson, time frame of a few weeks, I suppose they'll need 3 weeks.
Do you want to, because
so that we can.
There was a time frame in terms of the deadline for the actual appointment, and the earlier questioner asked, what are the steps and the time frames of each of those steps leading up to the 30th of September, or is it something that could be forwarded to us or something? Is it something that's here?
It's in the document. However, Chair, I can wrap.
Just summarize it quickly.
I can update you on where we are. We've, like we said, we already have the six. We've actually sent them, asked for more information because what was on the advert was a high-level thing. It actually now give us more details on the things that we're actually going to be evaluating them on. We're at a point where we just maybe need to look for a day that works for the members of the committee and the office to go through that, and I think it's actually maybe more like a one-day exercise. If we're able to pick a clear winner without asking people to come and do presentations, we'll do that. However, if we think there are a few people that are tight, what we might do is actually we'll then just have a formal work.
I thought a decision was made that we're not going to do the adjudication here, but that we're going to make an appointment. If that is the general view of this committee, it means we're not going to be sitting here and get people coming to address us one by one.
No, I'm talking about us.
Yeah. So how you do it yourself, all we need to know is just the steps and the time frames that you are setting for yourself to do all those processes.
That's what I'm saying. We need, once we found the day,
a day for us.
You say the committee, you're not referring to...
I'm talking about the audit committee.
Because there are two different committees.
I'm talking about...
No, that's fine. If we get the day...
We should actually be able to meet the mid-September. That's actually what we want to do.
What you can do is that once all of that is finalized, you can just send a message to the committee section, to the secretary of the committee, to say the audit committee has finalized its program as follows for the adjudication, and show the dates when you're going to do the different things. So that we too can plan our own scheduling of a day when we are going to do to entertain your recommendation for appointment.
What we did, just from a practical point of view, in the past, you might want to do that. Once we went through these processes, either myself as the chairman will talk to the chairman of the committee and actually take the chair through the process so that you're actually happy with it, so that by the time it goes to the committee.
No, that's fine. I from time to time, I go to meet the Auditor General over a cup of coffee, either at his office or he comes to my office, and we deal with all the logistical issues. And we also have a management committee where the staff from the AG office, the staff from Parliament, and ourselves sit and just deal with some of the logistical issues in preparation, so that we don't bore the committee with all the nitty-gritty things that still need to be further sorted and so on. All right. That should take us to the end of today. Unfortunately, we assumed that our engagement with the audit committee was going to be a quick exercise, but it turned out that, in fact, it shouldn't be a quick exercise, especially because of the role that they play, which is critical to our own role, because their role directly reinforces our own role in terms of their oversight function. So I think in future, chances are that we'll be interacting more with you and probably spending more time with you than we had originally thought we needed to, now that we understand clearly what your role is.
The one thing that was not on the agenda that I wanted us to discuss, we can discuss it later. We had a standing arrangement with the previous SCOAC that we talked about how often should we engage, so that we put it in our own work schedule. We specifically said we definitely have to meet at least once a year after the annual report is out, so that we can actually talk about that, but we also gave ourselves provision to meet and actually talk about the working in the last 2 years. We've met with SCOAC on at least 2 occasions, and we actually, so it's something that maybe in your workshop we might actually want to, we don't necessarily need an answer now, as long as we have an answer by the time that we've our next meeting.
All right, look, I don't want to take too much of your lunch time because you have to go back to go to the house as well. But what I, in response to that, I just want to indicate it's part of the issues relating to the development of the program of the committee. We are planning that at our next meeting, one of the issues we're going to look at is the program. But we wanted the program to not precede the induction process, because you can't develop a program on something you don't understand or know. So we thought, let's first finalize this first phase of getting to understand our role, getting to understand yourselves and the AG's office and how all these other structures such as yourselves relate and so on. Then we would be in a better position to assess for ourselves how best to structure our program along those lines. So definitely that point will be taken care of in the context of the program of the committee. And of course, when we develop the program, when it comes to dates and so on, our officials would interact with your officials to actually find an ideal space or date or time that is conducive to everybody. Otherwise, it would be pointless to schedule a meeting that will be overseas or simply committed elsewhere. All right. On that note, I would like to thank the Auditor General for indulging us, the Deputy Auditor General, and your report staff. We are sorry that we dwelt on the Audit Committee. I think we're still closing up with the Audit Committee, so you'll bear with us. In preparation of our long-standing relationship for the next 5 years. but thank you for your patience with us. I know members would have laughed. But there are tenure to be extended there. You can speak to Nkosi Olomisa. He chairs the Constitutional Review. Maybe he'll amend the Constitution. Anyway, to yourself, Chairperson of the...